Good afternoon and welcome to Wanda's Picks Summer Edition. We are broadcasting at a different time, and so the normal opening remarks don't work because, you know, it's not 6 o'clock in the morning. It is 12 in the afternoon, Pacific time, and it is sunny in Oakland. Thank goodness, because it's been so, so cold. Who knows how long the sun is going to last, because this is summertime. And I don't know if the living is easy, but it's definitely chilly. We have a really wonderful show planned today. We're going to be talking to Richard Moore, also known as Paradise, Free Ja Love. And Paradise is going to be telling us about the World Fair kickoff this Sunday. Oakland is going to be having a World Fair, and we're so looking forward to finding out more about that. And
hello.
Oh, there you are. Yeah,
hey.
I was telling folks that you're going to be telling us about the World Fair kickoff this Sunday and what the plans are for the rest of the months between the kickoff and the closing ceremonies. And President Obama is going to be in town, and hopefully he can pop through and christen the World Fair in Oakland. That should be really nice. And then we're going to also be joined this afternoon by Napoleon Revels Bay, and he's a drummer visiting us from New York, and he has a gig at Floyd Pelham's 57th Street Gallery this month as well. And it is the 10th anniversary of the International Black Women's Film Festival, and that kicks off this Friday and Saturday, and you can't believe the price, free. So we're going to be talking to about at least 4 or 5 of the directors that have film screening in this remarkable and wonderful film festival that's going to be on both sides of the bay. It's going to be at the Kaiser Center in Oakland, in their theater on Friday, I believe. And then on Saturday, it's going to be over in San Francisco at the main library. And then we're going to close our show today with an interview with James Tyrone. What's James' last name? I just lost it that quickly. James Tyrone. Let me look really quickly. He is one of the actors in the Scottsboro Boys, which is over at the American Conservatory Theater, I believe, through this weekend as well. There's just too much stuff happening this weekend in Oakland. That's why we need a World Fair. let me find Tyrone's last name for you. It's on the tip of my tongue. I think it's Jones, but I'm not quite certain. Lane. It's James Tyrone Lane, and he plays quite a few characters of the Scottsboro Boys. He portrays Ozzy Powell, who's 15 years old when he is arrested, and he also plays Ruby Bates. So we have an interesting conversation that I'm sure you're going to enjoy. It was recorded last week, so he's not actually going to be live in the studio. So let's talk to Paradise. How'd you come up with a great name like that? It just makes you feel good saying your name.
That is the purpose, to make people feel good, to remind them and myself why we're here and of our purpose to establish paradise on earth. Yes.
Right. Yeah. And Paradise was born in Oakland's Highland Hospital, and he graduated from Berkeley High School. He majored in English and creative writing at Xavier University in New Orleans. He played pro basketball in Argentina for Club
Almirante
Brown. What is that, Club Almirante Brown?
It's one of the professional teams in Argentina.
They're still going strong?
In Puerto Madryn.
Okay.
No, I think that particular team is defunct now. No fault of my own. But, you know, the European leagues and other leagues around the world aren't as strong as the NBA and aren't as solid. But I had a great time that year in Argentina and learned a lot. And so I just want to say, Wanda Sabir, have no fear, be of good cheer. Paradise is here. And today I am meeting all the right people. I am saying all the right things. I am thinking all the right thoughts turning in all the right directions and appearing in all the right scenes, because I know that the purpose of everything is to rise and shine. And the essence of beautiful is beautiful. And wherever the beautiful ones gather and go, the rest of the world will inevitably follow. And I just wanted to get that little spill out of the way.
Yes, another gem.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show, too. I'm so blessed and honored.
Oh, well, thank you. I think this might be the second time you've been on the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been way too many years between those appearances. We have to have you on more in the near future. You definitely have to have you come back to talk about the closing ceremony. But I remember when I met you, it was because you are such a literary ambassador. And I remember when you were president and still are president of the International Black Writers and Artists Incorporated, Local 5 in Oakland, and you have our monthly meetings over at the Diamond Branch Library and upstairs. And that was the days when, you know, Miss Ella Crutchfield was around.
Give thanks.
Yeah. And who, do you remember the Black Writers Guild? Is that Miss Crutchfield?
Yeah, it was the Oakland Black Writers Guild.
Yeah,
I forgot.
That?
And Patricia, I forget Patricia's last name, but she was the president.
We were just, I mean, people think that, you know, the cafe scene is happening. Black folks were writing all over the Bay Area. I mean, we were in cafes, we were in soul food restaurants. We were all, I mean, we were in the libraries. We put on writers' conferences throughout California and throughout the country. And I don't know, we just had like a serious presence. And I remember when you wrote that poem about Oakland, because you talked about how when you see the signs for Oakland, it would say, entering Oakland, like, beware.
Yes. And they say that that poem that I wrote called Entering Oakland, which was a spoof of those signs, was a catalyst in spearheading the drive to get the signs changed to welcome to Oakland, like a normal city. But, you know, although some people like the Entering Oakland signs because they say it gave Oakland that special flavor that it is, you know, so.
Right. Yeah. And I remember when, you know, when you were taking care of your grandmother and when you did that experiment of being a poet, you know, with, you know, living sort of with the, you know, the creative energy of the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And was that for a year that you intentionally, like, were a poet that didn't have your name on a lease somewhere, you know? and I don't know, I mean, it seemed like a real creative, physical, like, you know, kinesthetic kind of interaction you had around that. I was like, wow, really? He's like intentionally not having an abode, like a house, a home. Like, wow, that is really amazing.
Well, kind of, sort of, in a way. Today is called being homeless. And, yes, at first I thought it was going to be romantic. I was like, I'm going to be like the blues singer. You know, I'm going to have a reason to articulate some angst, right? But man, that cold and that concrete ain't no joke. It's hard out there for a poet, you know. It can be hard out there for a poet. But yeah, that was an experience, and it's like when you are at the bottom, what else do you have to fear? You know, like J.B. Lenore, the blues singer, saying, "I've been down so long. Being down, do not bother me no more."
Right. So. Yeah. And then I believe from that experience came your the Street Spirit, a poetry magazine.
Well, a lot happened in 1995. Mm-hmm. That was a very crucial year in my life, because in that year I wrote the poem song, "I Love Everything About You But You," which is the Black
National
Underground classic and anthem, some people call it. That year, I also conceived the idea for Street Spirit, a newspaper and or a magazine that the homeless could sell and that poets would be able to publish in and get exposure. And also that year, I started the Afro-Metropolitan Poetry Series, which was the flagship series that kind of like kick-started the present-day poetry boom, or what I call the continuation of the California Poetry Gold Rush. Mm-hmm. Yeah, too. And its purpose is to make literacy popular and dynamic and just enriching this whole culture, because what has happened is there's been like a disconnect between the elders, the civil rights generation, the black power movement generation, and between the youth, a disconnect between the artists and the intellectuals and the rest of the community. So this cultural world's fair is meant to help inspire that reconnect, because the only reason that what's happening in Oakland is happening is because the youth are lacking knowledge. You know, like Elijah Muhammad said, if you give a person has, all a person has is a dirty glass of water to drink, that's what they'll drink, right? But if you give them a clean glass of water, they will naturally go to that. And it's the same thing with our youth. If you give them a clean slate, a chance to be prosperous and live a happy, wholesome life, equal opportunity, you know, they will naturally move in that direction. So it's just about the information, getting the information, knowledge, you know, some real knowledge out to the people, you know, which the media could do if they really wanted to overnight. But it's like they prefer the system of managed mayhem, chaos and disorder, so they could continue to fix things from the top, you know.
Yeah. Well, you're always creating these institutions. You know, you've got the Afro-Metropolitan Poetry Series.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when you had that series at the Pena Culture Center, and we were like trade off. I think you
oh,
had the
best,
fourth, and
the
I
best.
Had the fifth, and then you do these mm-hmm. Cleopatra balls, and
thank you.
And now you're at Shashamani, you know, the Ethiopian restaurant named after the place where
yes.
Haile Selassie, King Haile Selassie, invited Africans in the diaspora to come home.
Yeah.
You know, come home, and that place exists. Like, we can still do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, wow, that's so cool. And yeah, so tell us about. Gosh, you got so many, and you have such great names for your different series.
That's
and
part
then you,
of it.
And then I remember you were a part of the Afro Solo. That was really cool. Shock the World, Malcolm, Martin, Muhammad Ali.
Yes.
And you are such a great actor, and you get so into character. Like we think we are seeing, you know, Martin King coming back, and we think we're seeing you know, our brother Muhammad Ali, like, oh, yeah, he's, like, coming over to the West Coast to visit us in Oakland today.
Yeah.
It's really, really cool. So talk about sort of how that, you know, coalesces into, you know, this current project, which is huge, a world festival
mm-hmm.
in Oakland.
Well, that's one of the offices and duties of the poet, to be a voice for the voiceless, you know. So Muhammad Ali can't speak anymore, so an artist should do it. You know, Martin is no longer here, so an artist should bring us that flavor and let the youth and those up and coming know what that person was like. Malcolm is no longer here, so the artist, you know. And I started the Hail Bebop music series, you know, alongside the Afro-Metropolitan Poetry Series to connect the elders with the youth again by showing films of Afro-classical musicians, music, yeah, and having young groups come and see that and hear the mini lecture and then perform. So connecting them. And then, yeah, the Oakland's a Holy City Poetry Series, was awesome. And then what you were talking about, the Best in the West Grand Slam Poetry Series, which offered poets $1,000 at a time, and from 1998 to 2001, with the help of black businesses and community-friendly businesses, I was able to give away over $11,000 in cash and prizes. So during the course of all this time, I've run into a lot of wonderful, including yourself, people and artists who are like diamonds. And Mary Rudge wrote this poem called Oakland is the Holy City, right?
Yeah, Mary's wonderful. She's the poet laureate in Alameda, California.
And I was like, at first, what? Oakland, a holy city? Huh? And then I was like, wait a minute. Mary's here. I'm here. One of the Bears here. The spirit of the Ohlone Indians is here. The Panthers came up from here. The Kwanzaa, first Kwanzaa was given in this area. Free speech movement, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and so on and so on and so forth. And I'm like, wow. And more stuff started coming to me, and I was like, dang, the greater Oakland, East Bay, the greater Oakland, San Francisco Bay Area is the spiritual metropolis of planet Earth. We have the best climate spiritually, culturally, economically, socially, agriculturally, and environmentally, in the sense that down south sometimes it gets too hot, and up north and back east sometimes it gets too cold, but we never have any unbearable summers or intolerable winters, and we have the opportunity to work 24/7, 365 to do the work and get Oakland thriving like it really should be, and be that model city that leads all the other cities in the right direction. If you live in Oakland right now, you have your hands on the steering wheel of the world, and there's not a more important job in the world than the work that you, who's ever listening, who's ever is here, was sent to do. So that's a very powerful and dynamic thing to know, and I want people to know that so we can pull a cultural coup on this bad boy.
Yeah, so what are the plans for the World Fair? Tell us about events and how people can find out more and be involved. And
most definitely, first and foremost, let me say that you can go to www.2012worldsfair.wordpress.com. And this year I was like, whoa, this is the year that I've been telling everybody about. But hey, I don't have any money. And enthusiasm is not enough. And for a half a second I thought about not giving it, but then I said, like, okay, wait a minute, I've been telling people I was going to do this for too long. I have to do something. So I said, okay, at least I'm going to give the opening reception. And when people hear about that, they'll be like, okay, I remember, yeah, I'm talking about that, and, you know, just create a buzz. And then I was like, wait a minute. The mayor of Oakland, Ron Dellums, in the city of Oakland, gave me in 2007 Paradise Day on October 6th. So I said, oh, wow, so that'll be the closing reception. So we'll have opening and closing reception, and then in between that, we'll have as many events as possible. But also listed on the site will be all the great things that are happening in the Bay Area during the summer, like the Fillmore Jazz Festival, the Marin County Fair, the Alameda Fair, the North Beach, Wolsey Church Jazz Festival, you know, from big to small and in between. Just list all that, and inevitably have a cultural world's fair where the brightest minds and the biggest hearts and the greatest artists from all the around the world will come here and want to be a part of this culture and this aliveness and this genius and this awesome spirit that we have here. And Originally, it was called, and it still is in essence, a Back to Africa World's Fair Tour, because the original idea was to have the first one in Oakland, and then the next one in New Orleans or Atlanta down south, and then New York, Chicago, Haiti, Belize, but you know, to follow our path back to Africa, and then the last one in 2056 in South Africa, so to the very bottom, you know, of Africa from here, and just take all that energy and spirit and knowledge that the people need. The difference between a world's fair and a culture world's fair is that in a world's fair, you have to move and build buildings and rides and things, but a cultural world's fair is about moving people and building culture and community. No, so.
Oh, interesting. So I know you have something this Sunday, right? Or
yes, that's going to be the opening reception at 1701 University Avenue in Berkeley, 3 p.m. It's going to be like a 40-year Bay Area poets and artists family reunion. So if you know of any poets and artists out there, folks, please tell them to come through. We want all the folks who are poets and artists and all the present and ex poetry series and their groups to come through. International Black Writers and Artists, Oakland Writers Guild, PEN.
Black Poets with Attitudes.
Yes, PEN Oakland, Sisters with Gaps, you know. Everybody to come on through, because we're going to have some food, beverages, and it's free. Donations appreciated, because the donations will help further the cause of this cultural world's fair and the various projects that I have, like the Black Oscars and Buy Black Wednesday. And
yeah, because that was really great bringing back, because I remember on Don Warden's show, that was the first place I ever heard about buying black on Wednesday. And when my children were growing up, if we couldn't find a place to buy, you know, support a black business, we just didn't spend any money on Wednesdays.
Okay.
And so it kind of hard, like, what if you need a cleaners? Okay, and you're in
mm-hmm.
Oakland, the cleaners is in Richmond, California.
Mm.
So it's like, okay, well, you have to plan, like,
mm-hmm.
What if you need a you know, your shoes fixed? Where is the black business that fixes
mm-hmm.
shoes? Okay, what if you ran out of food? Where is the black grocer? you need to go to a physician. Where are the black doctors? It really is a great way to see what type of commerce we need to develop, because we see where there are spaces, you know, in our economy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another great way of looking at buying black on Wednesday, because if you can't find the cleaners, okay, well, we need to develop that particular industry. If we don't have enough food,
mm-hmm.
then we need to make sure that we have, you know, more community gardens, you know, more grocery stores like Mandela and the People's Grocery Store, you know, those kind of things, as opposed to, you know, going to the corporate places. So I just thought that was great when you brought that back. It was like that went viral, as they say.
All right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's once again trying to reconnect the disconnect and re-blackify what's been de-blackified, you know, because integration was kind of like disintegration, you know, for us. So it's just trying to get us back in that frame of mind that we have to support each other. And until we get it like Black Wall Street again, we have to go out of our way the extra mile and perhaps spend the extra dollar. You know, like you see the Asian lady in the hood at the wee hours at the night getting cans and bottles and taking them back to Chinatown. So if the elders can do that, you know, what can we young folks do, you know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I'm just trying to incorporate all that into one cultural mix. So.
Yeah, yeah, and I was looking at some of the titles of some of your poetry series, Holla Back, which is now, you know, that's what people call the poetry, call it Holla Back.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the Black Rep, you had Third Eye, E-Y-E.
Third Eye Theater.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I was like, wow.
Another one called Poet School.
Poet School.
The Oakland's Holy City Poetry Reading.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I was looking at that you play one of the lead roles in Mac, A Gangster Tale, an urban adaptation of Shakespeare's Macbeth. Was that with Ayadeli and Zynga's theater, or?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, she's doing something now. Uh-huh. Tell us about that.
That was an awesome experience. She wrote an incredible adaptation of Shakespeare's play, Macbeth, I think it was, and she called it Mac, and she brought it to the hood, and she did just an incredible job, and that was an awesome experience. It was a challenge for me and something that I can pat myself on the back for, and because I like to act. I like to do various different things to strengthen my poetry and just myself overall as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
So I have another poem called Why Oakland Has No Record Stores, and another one called Why Is There No Theater in Oakland? And until then, when will we learn how to act? So it's very important to support Word Slinger, as I call her, and as she calls herself when she's doing a spoken word.
Right, yeah.
And the Prescott Joseph Center and what's that, Thea Bowman
Theater. Yeah. And then she's got, right now they're doing August Wilson's Ma Rainey's Black Bottom,
mm-hmm.
and her resident theater is called the Lower Bottom Players, Playaz, Players.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually have a website, Lower Bottom Players, because they're in what's called in West Oakland, the Lower Bottoms.
Mm-hmm.
And she has their Tales of Iron and Water. And the theater is located in the backyard of the Prescott Joseph Center, right, exactly. And it's 920 Peralta Street. And so it goes through this weekend, the 20th, 21st, and 22nd, so you can catch that. So we have like 2 minutes. Why don't you give us a poem?
Well, I wanted to mention that back in the day, mm-hmm. we had, just in the Bay Area alone, almost 40 black bookstores. And now I hear there are only 40 in the whole country. So. And I was talking to Lou Makonda, and he was
how's he doing?
He's great, but he was one of the people that had bookstores. And
Bookshop, yeah. And mm-hmm. he got gentrified out after the Loma Prieta earthquake.
Yeah, he said the rent went up from 50 cents to a square foot to $2, you know,
yeah.
after the earthquake. So.
Right, yeah.
And he also said there used to be a store called the Moore Store, which is bigger than Marcus. But we have to.
The Moore, like as in Moore Science Temple Moore? That comes
No, because his name was, last name was Moore. The brother's last name was M.
Oh, okay. M O O R. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
But yeah, so we need to support our cathedrals of Afrocentricity and raise more of them. But I guess I can end with the underground classic, I love everything about you, but you. And black people say that they like this because it validates them. I love everything about you, but you. It's the chorus. I say that 4 times usually. I love everything about you, but you. And I do this at Maafa every year. I love everything about you, but you. They want the black spirit. They want the black mind. They want the black soul. They want the black behind. They want the black muscle. They want the black heart. They want the black music. They want the black art. They want the black rhythm. They want the black hips. They want the black power. They want the black lips. They want the black style. They want the black talk. They want the black skills. They want the black walk. They want the black ride. They want the black heat. They want the black coffee. They want the black meat. They want the black land. They want the black gold. They want the black diamonds. They want the black coal. They want the black oil. They want the black race. They want the black earth. They want the black space. They want the black dollars. They want the black gods. They want the black everything but me and you. Now that's odd, man. They want the black neighborhoods but not the black neighbor. What are they trying to say? Oh, I love everything about you but you. And that's all, folks.
Yeah, thank you. Well, you're just doing some great work. Great work as a literary presence, and it's definitely not. You know, you're not getting rich on doing this. I mean, you're really.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah. I mean, you're. But yet, I mean, every time I see you, you look younger. You're glowing. So. You know, what you're doing is definitely one sees the vibration and the love for our people, you know, sort of coming through your pores.
Oh,
and
okay.
You know, when one thinks that this is really creative and you come up with something else, it's just like you're just like a font. And
okay.
And I'm really happy that we've been able to collaborate on so many wonderful ventures, and looking forward to more, particularly around this World Fair. Definitely want to, you know, have a concrete presence in that as we move toward the closing ceremonies in October, I think. Or are the closing ceremonies in October, on Paradise Day? In
Yeah. Okay. Well, actually, it's the day after Paradise Day. So what I would like to try to do is bring the World's Fair to Ma'afa, because that's going to be the day of Ma'afa, and then have something outside, but then have something inside to close the World's Fair, you know, and hopefully by then it would have picked up some steam. And related to what you were saying earlier about not making money, I'm like Amari Baraka, who said, I got the award, now I'm waiting for the reward.
Right, yeah. Yeah, well, you know, we could turn that around, you know. I mean, it's nice to be rich in spirit, but you need some pocket change.
Mm-hmm.
So give us your website one more time, because my other guest is waiting in the wings.
Okay, yeah, and also you can reach me on Facebook at Paradise the Poet and pdice18@yahoo.com, and the fair website is where you'll find all of that, is www.2012.com. worldsfair.wordpress.com. Peace.
All right,
Amani.
All right, peace and blessings. Well, we are joined, I hope, in the studio by Mr. Napoleon Revels Bay. Good afternoon. How are you?
How are you, my sister?
I'm good. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Great. Glad you could join us. East Coast, on the West Coast, right?
Yeah, something like that, right?
yeah. You're going to have a concert. I mentioned earlier when I was letting our audience know what was coming up today in our show that you have a concert at the Floyd Pelham's 57th Street Gallery on the 27th.
Yes, we're going to be I'm going to be performing on the 27th, yes. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Right. Really nice. Let me tell our audience a little bit about you. Mr. Revels Bay's work as a musician and educator is a long history of stellar associations. Much sought after as a musician in the worlds of Broadway, soul, and jazz, he has done percussion on the Broadway productions of Jelly's Last Jam, West Side Story, Bubblin' Brown Sugar, Dancin', Ain't Misbehavin', and Yubi. Mr. Revels Bay has worked with Gladys Knight, Gregory Hines, Aretha Franklin, and Cab Calloway. His world-class achievements have brought him to jazz festivals in Europe and Japan. He is a member of the Percussive Art Society, both of Nassau, Suffolk, and Westchester. What does BOCES stand for?
Oh, BOCES is the Board of Cooperative Education, and also be doing something for the Kennedy Center this August. I'll be going down there for a seminar for teaching artists.
Nice, nice. And you're also a member of the International Association of Jazz Educators and the American Federation of Musicians. And I saw you at Mr. Randy Weston's concert this past weekend, and it was really great to see you, because I'm really interested in percussion players and drummers, particularly trap set drummers. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about sort of how you came to the music? I mean, because you've done a whole lot.
Thank you.
And this is not all you do either. Because you were telling me about your membership and leadership in the Moorish Science Temple. Yeah, so.
Yes, I'm a member of the Moorish Science Temple. Been there since about 1972. Been a member, and now I'm one of the temples there. Temple 21 has been in Brooklyn since 1933. It's been chartered since 1933. I wasn't there in 1933, but it's been chartered since 1933. And as far as the musical, and I started when I was about 10, I believe it was like 10 by 16, I gravitated toward percussion, and my parents wanted me to, you know, I took formal lessons. I went to college, SUNY Old Westbury, studied with Lakonda, Ken McIntyre, Warren Smith, a percussionist who worked with Oom Boom and Max Roach and Joe Chambers and a lot of great, Tony Williams. And so through that experience at the college is how I got more involved in doing Broadway percussion and our drum set. And through Warren, the great teacher Warren Smith, and then from Warren I wound up doing what they call arts and education programs. We do workshops, assemblies in schools. I have an arts organization called Revels Bay Music and Nassau Performing Arts, Inc., and we, you know, provide services to the schools as far as education. In fact, I'm going to be doing Marcus Books this coming Sunday at 2 o'clock. I'm going to do like a little children's workshop about, it's called From El Andalusia to Dizzy, so it's what people term as an Afro-Cuban type of style of music. I talk a little bit about the Moors in Spain, West African Bantu rhythms, into the Caribbean islands, into New Orleans, and that's how we trace the music. And the music on a Friday, I'll do a short dissertation prior to actually playing some of the music where we're going to be doing basically a tribute to Eddie Marshall and a few other great drummers that I've known, Art Blakey, ETC. And in New York, we did a thing for Buhana where it's a little different because a lot of that work is with my Bobby Timmons and Wayne Shorter. And so what we do is what people call Afro-Cuban style, a little bit of the music, and it's basically jazz music. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So talk a little bit about, you know, sort of how – you know, the drum is you know, sort of your vehicle of expression. Why percussion? What about it called you? And called you and you know, sort of that's what you've been doing all of your life.
My first instrument was I had taken like most children, you take, you know, music lessons, which happens to be in the form of piano, or you take study guitar or whatever. And I guess my first introduction was playing piano because my mother, you know, told us that we had to learn a musical instrument, and so it was piano. And then I happened to gravitate towards the percussion end, the drum end. I guess like most children, drums and guitars are some of the biggest selling instruments in the United States. So, you know, you see a lot of drummers on TV or whatever, so a lot of us gravitate towards the drums. So that's how I gravitated towards the drums, and I took formal lessons along the way. I studied with a gentleman by the name of Charles Perry and a few other great teachers. And then through them, they molded me, I guess, as far as hearing all the great drummers like Max and Tony and Roy. Roy Haynes was just in town. Roy was in town about a week ago before I got here. No, the week we got here, Roy was in town.
Yeah, he was over at the Stanford Jazz Festival, yeah.
Mm-hmm, yeah, him. And so along the way, you meet great musicians like the great Randy Weston, who is great encouragement for us as musicians. And hopefully we can filter that down to our young people so that they'll understand this great music and the history where it comes from and get a deeper appreciation of their music. And that's what most of us wind up, I think, maybe forced to do, but I don't know if it's forced to do this, but we want to do was to, you know, reach out to the younger audience so that because the music isn't being heard as much as other forms of music, but yet and still we do our best to, you know, propagate this great music.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one thinks about sort of the history of music, American music, and one thinks about you know, this jazz idiom. You know, it sort of parallels the development of you know, it actually parallels the African struggle and presence in this country, arrival, and those of us that experience, you know, enslavement, which is the majority of us, it documents that too, and then it documents emancipation, and also Jim Crow, and then the Civil Rights Movement, and then, you know, these different opportunities that the sort of the rise and fall of democracy. And one also says, I mean, I've also seen it and heard that within on the bandstand, you know, that, you know, sort of the way that the ensemble is set up, it also is a metaphor for what has happened to, you know, us as a people, and also sort of it's a metaphor for a democratic society. And I was wondering if you could talk about sort of the development of the music and how it's how you made it unique to yourself, and what you're saying with your instrument. And also if you could tell us sort of, I know musicians, they play, I mean, it's a drum set or it's a percussion instrument, but tell us what you play exactly.
I play drums, which is multiple percussion, you know, one person playing cymbals and snares and tom-toms and things of that nature. Historically speaking, our program is I call from El Andalusia to Dizzy, meaning we started with the Moors in Spain, at least on that time frame of the people of African descent in the United States. Being a member of the Moorish Science Temple of America, we have a little bit of a different take on, not necessarily take, we just try and let our people know that certain things that happened was, people don't like to hear, but it was because of our fault, of our lack of, really, to be honest with you, we say following our God, you know. And so my program is a little bit different. So when I talk about the Moors in Spain, I'm not necessarily talking about, well, your existence as a people of African descent in the United States started with slavery. We go back a little bit further than that. We talk about the ancient Moabites who inhabited the northwestern and southwestern shores of Africa, and their dominion and habitation extended across the Great Atlantic and is now the present North, South, and Central America. So in my program, I talk about that because most of us have heard about Western history, meaning that you read about, you know, Mr. Christopher Columbus, and, you know, talk about the downfall of the Moors in Granada, Spain, you know, and then okay, now this thing called colonialism starts up and, you know, going into Cuba and things like that. But we try, in my program, which is going to be the children's program, I'm not necessarily talking that. I'm basically saying how your forefathers are already, they've always been here, you know, prior to slavery, prior to colonialism. They traveled up and down the mighty Mississippi River. People call them all kind of different names, but they were basically of Moorish descent. And so when I talk about that, and you mentioned Jim Crow and stuff like that, so when you mention that, which I don't necessarily get into the program, I do that, you know, when we talk about the Moorish Science Temple and its foundation, is that that's a period of history of which people need to know a little bit more prior to that, because what happens is by 1913, with the advent of the Moorish Science Temple, Prophet Noble Drolley, the founder, getting here, that's when the tides have been changed. And it's very interesting to hear about the Great Migration, because I was doing a program once, and they were talking about, people might be familiar with what is called the Chicago Defender, which was one of the oldest Asiatic or so-called African descent paper in the United States, and they were telling people to come north and new jobs and new opportunities. It's 1926, if I'm correct, 1926, maybe a little earlier than that. And that's when the foundation of the Moorish Science Temple began. Actually, in 1913, the Prophet then went to Chicago, and about 25, 26, in Moorish Holy Temple of Science, and which evolved into the Moorish Science Temple of America. And he was teaching our people that they weren't Negroes, Blacks, colored folks, all of these slave names, and that who you were, who your ancient forefathers were, you were without doubt or contradiction. That's how Brother Rebels Bay, you know, got into the Moorish Science Temple, because I never heard that. I always thought that, you know, history started, well, 1774 and things like that, you know, downtrodden and so on and so on and so on. But I never knew that our ancient forefathers go back much further than that. And the Moors are just one example of a dynasty of people, And it's not about hating anybody. It's just about trying to learn the truth, you know. And when you begin to understand how you have to learn to love instead of hate, that's what the program evolved. And through the program, I was able to go in and understand how our ancient forefathers were all over the planet, you know, and through intermarriage and integration. Yeah, we intermingle with other people, so you really can't look at people through a hue or a skin tone and say, oh, well, they were so-called African and they were so... No, if you go back further, there's this thing called amalgamation, and that's how people get mingled up, you know. But if you go all the way back, you know, my program starts with the ancient Moabites who inhabit the northwest and southwestern shores of Africa. But we basically start with the Moors in Spain because people mainly know about the Moors in Spain and the great things that they did. Running water, lights, sherbet, you know, all these great things that people have heard about, you know. And music, you know, it wasn't just the drum. I think that's a misnomer. And I'm a drummer, you know. But I think it's a misnomer to think that, well, everybody that played came from the continent of Africa, they just play hand drums. That's not true. They had horns. They had everything else. And when it came to the United States with this whole amalgamation that happened around New Orleans time, even Jelly Roll Martin knew that you had to have what he called a Latin tinge. Mm-hmm. And he was basically talking about this thing that if it didn't have this swing kind of feeling to it that people call swing, which is they call clave and Afro-Cuban style music. And when you see the program, I talk about the clave a lot because it's not what people could concern Latinized. It's really Africanized in the sense that the Moors were doing it, and then people of Spanish speaking, when they dominated, then they did something else, and people of another, they dominated, they called it something else. And I traced it, and I showed the people, I'm going to show it in the program, how that same five notes, people do that in schools to tell the children to sit down. If you can hear me, they go like this. And this in New York, they go like this, pop, 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 pop. And all the children clap back, pop, 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 five notes. But in the music, we go bop, ah, like that. Or you go ah. So that music is called cha-cha, it's called merengue, you know, it's called hip-hop. I do a program, I play hip-hop, and I think it was 50 Cent was one of the first that I heard, not only him, but others that we use these five notes, you know, and I could hear it in the music, and we try to show the children how those five notes are still integrated into your music today. So I'm not bragging about what we did, I'm just so honored to find out some of the connections and to hopefully show the young people that they'll hear the connections in their own music and show you where your ancient forefathers have put a twist on this thing called music. They've always been innovative with drums and timpani and mallet instruments and horns. You know, Hannibal and them had trouble. You know, all of these things are part of your ancient forefathers. And the gift that you have given the world is a wonderful thing, but if you don't know you have a gift and somebody makes you think, well, they're the ones that invented it, and they might have helped improve it along the way, then we show that too. So, again, the program is about trying to learn to love instead of hate, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. I was wondering, you sent me some of your music, and I noticed some of it you have vocalists, and you have really, really dynamite musicians performing with you, you know, on these pieces. I was just, you know, listening to the piece where you have a vibraphonist performing.
That's Brian.
The one on is that the cherry pink and apple blossom white?
Yeah, cherry pink and apple blossom white. That's the old standard dance song that people play in the dance halls in New York, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we were trying to do with our program was to show the new with the young, and I still like the song enough, I always did like it, so we play it, you know. Here in New York, here in California, Glenn Pearson is going to be on piano.
Oh, nice.
You know, he has a great feel for the quote-unquote Afro-Cuban style as well as the jazz style. And so it'll be a quartet. And on the CD, I try to get some of my friends to be a part of that. We're working on another CD. That CD's, you know, we'll have the CD for sale there, but we're also going to probably have a CD giveaway, you know, and that kind of thing like that to try and promote the music. And hopefully the people will come away tapping their feet a little bit, and that's a good thing. You know, you want to tap their feet, you know, and make it very pleasant. Not necessarily trying to make the music, lowest common denominator, but you're trying to make it so that it's still enjoyable and it hopefully will get you to thinking and, you know, and hopefully you'll walk away learning a little bit of something about this great music that we call jazz, Afro-Cuban music. Now they call it hip-hop, they call it R&B. All of these things are part of the great diaspora of, I call it Moorish American music. Mm-hmm. And those of African descent, you know, and those of Europe too, you know, I'm not discounting that, you know, because everybody has contributed of some form of fashion, you know. So that's how that goes.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And again, Napoleon Raffles Bay, his concert is going to be on Saturday.
Friday.
Oh, is that a Friday? Oh.
Yeah, it's Friday, July 27th.
Oh, is that a Friday? Okay. Because I thought it was a Friday. Oh, it is a Friday because the 13th, the 20th, 27th. You're right.
Mm-hmm.
yes, it's a Friday. And what time? What time is the concert?
I believe it starts. We're supposed to start at 8 o'clock.
Okay, cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then the children's concert is going to be this Saturday, Sunday rather, the 22nd. That's going to be at Marcus Bookstores. I think I gave you on the flip side of the flyer. That's going to be at Marcus Bookstores at 2 o'clock, and that's the San Francisco one. And I wanted to go there because, you know, Marcus Books was one of the oldest bookstores of Moorish or those of African descent. So I said, oh, it'd be nice to do a little presentation there, you know. So I'm hoping that they'll bring a lot of young people. Older people welcome to come too, but bring somebody young. Bring some babies. Bring some of our babies up in there, you know, and get them playing and clapping. Everybody's invited to play along. You can't bring any snare drums, but you're invited to bring some percussion with you because it's going to be interactive, you know. And I'm hoping next year when I come through, I'll do the same thing before our concert, have a children's concert before the regular concert so the babies can come out. We could talk, show them some things, and get them and, you know, hopefully raise up some children that, like Mingus said, let my children hear music, see. So once the children begin to hear it, there won't be this division about, well, your music is old, mine is new. So, you know, we need to do more of that so that our children need to hear more of the music, so that they'll become more well-informed and, you know, whether it be classical music, jazz music, Afro-Cuban music, you know, so they'll just be more educated as far as musically inclined. Anyway, as far as some of the musicians that I know, that's what we try and do.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And other songs that you sent me, you have this new Mo Swing?
Yeah, new Mo Swing. that's an acronym for, sometimes I feel N-E-W, sometimes a N-U. It's an acronym for New Moorish Swing.
Okay.
New Mo Swing, you know, and being Moorish American. We try and let out, like again, we, you know, the Moorish Science Temple is a great holy place to come, you know. And I know your show is not about necessarily religion, but, we want to give a lot of people know about the Moorish Science Temple of America, and please come and we have an online blog talk. One of the brothers has one out of Philadelphia, you know, and we want people to come and hear about the teachings of the last prophet in these days, his prophet Noble Drolley, just like I heard about other great brothers that were, you know, great religious figures that talked about meditation and knowing thyself and health. And that's what we try and do in the Moorish Science Temple. It's been a great place. I've been there, I raised my children there. And so out of this first CD was a dedication to that, you know. So some of the songs that we do, like we do A-Train, you know. The one I did called Up You Mighty, I gave you that one. Up You Mighty is an acronym for the forerunner of our movement. A lot of people know of him. His name is Marcus Messiah Garvey. And, you know, a lot of people don't know about Brother Marcus Garvey. I don't know if they know some of the inner things that he talked about. I mean, you know, people say, well, he said so-and-so. But they need to know some of the inner things that he said about taking care of your family, you know, looking about your economic welfare. Those are the same things that the Moorish Science Temple teaches too. And it's not about, I think sometimes people pull this thing about going after somebody else. It's not about that. It's about going after, if anything, go after yourself, you know, to better yourself. And then everything else will look better, you know, because if you work on your inner self that our temple teaches, then the world outside self looks really good once you work on the inner self. So the Up You Mighty was dedicated, Up You Mighty Race, that's what Brother Marcus Garvey said. So the song's called Up You Mighty. We're going to play that night, too. That's like a calypso.
Right.
People sound like a
calypso. Yeah, that was the one I really like, Up
You
Mighty.
Yeah, people
like
that.
Yeah, really
nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, people like that because that's
so I was thinking,
by Marcus Garvey. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really wonderful. And then the other one, Tight, that has a really wonderful vocalist because you have a wonderful singer. Is the same singer on that one that's on Cherry Pink and Apple Blossom?
Mm-hmm. That's Annette St. John, who's from New York, a great vocalist. And Tight, I don't know if you know, Tight is Betty Carter's song.
I didn't know
Betty
that.
Carter did Tight, yeah. And I always liked this way Betty Carter sang Tight, you know. Mm-hmm. And she sang, I think, live. I think the one I heard was right here in San Francisco at the Great Music Hall, I think it was called, something like
Great American Music Hall?
Yeah. So I got the first time I heard it, was her recording was there. You know, and I always liked the song. It was just simple, cute, you know, cute meaning, you know, just really nice lyrics and stuff, you know. So, and Betty Carter was just a great dynamic person as far as showing us a little bit about self-promotion and things like that. That before you had to self-promote, you know. So now you got to self-promote. That's just the way it is, you know.
Right.
But,
yeah,
we don't look at that
oneself
as a negative. It's a good thing, you know. Sometimes the musicians need to get together and realize that because it's so bad out here, it makes us good because, like Marcus Garvey, Prophet Noble Drew Ali, and them said, see, we can do this thing. We can build up our own institutions. You just got to come together.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't come together, you know, the major institutions are falling apart. And now they're realizing, well, the reason that we're falling apart, maybe we didn't learn about equity. We didn't learn about there's a covenant between the rich and the poor, you know. So when the rich start screaming, then that means the poor people, well, we've always been screaming because, you know, we never really did have. But it's what is happening, at least for me, at least I think within our context of us knowing and being part of Moorish Science Temple, is a great change coming. It's really not that bad. Your time has come. So look at it as a blessing, and just don't hate nobody for something that they did or their forefathers did years ago. Don't do that. You know all the ones that we love, and some of my people call heroes. Well, some of my heroes are not necessarily musicians. They're really the prophets: Jesus, Muhammad, Buddha, Confucius, etc. Prophet Noble Drew Ali. And when I translate that into the music, that's what happened to John Coltrane. See, that's how he found Love Supreme. People, they think of Love Supreme as a great song because he did, but they need to leave the lyrics. See, once you find that inner peace within and it comes with your connection with your creator, then things go a lot smoother. Who was it? Marvin Gaye. You know, if what's going on, that's how it happened to him too. So once people learn to discover that within self, then, see, the world is not that bad anymore, you know, and then you become a something for change for that which is good. And it's not about, again, hating somebody else to get to another level, see, because I don't want people to think that if I'm hating somebody else for what they did or what their forefathers did, that's just going to make me a better person. That's not true, because that whole cycle of hate will go round and round and round again. You've got to learn to love instead of hate. And all the ones that I'm talking about, that the ones that I really love, Jesus, Muhammad, Buddha, Confucius, that's what they did, see. And no matter when people came up to hate them, they still were loving. Forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. You know, so that's what you got to learn to do. And once people begin innerly to internalize that, it's really not that bad out here. This thing called life is just something we got to go through. It's going to perfect us to get all the way back to our creator. So that's Brother Rebels Bay's understanding of this great drama of life and music, which is just a small extract of that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right. Yeah.
Yes.
So I was thinking it'd be really nice to maybe close this our conversation with one of your pieces.
Yeah, it might be nice.
Yeah, I thought so
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm.
So let's play that. And looking forward to seeing you on the 27th at Floyd Pelham's 57th Street Gallery.
Yes, please.
And that's
do.
Located at. Looking for the address here. Where are you?
It's on Telegraph, I believe.
Yeah, it is Telegraph. I was looking for the street address. Oh, here it is over on the other side of the card. 5701 Telegraph Avenue, and they have a website,
mm-hmm.
really great, 5757thstreetgallery.com. And the phone number there is 510-654-6974. And why don't you give our audience your website?
Well, my website is www, of course, and then it's my last name, which is Aura E, V like in Victor, E. L-S dash, then B as in boy, E as in echo, Y as in youth.com. So it's rebelsbay.com. And I'm also on Facebook, the same Napoleon, N-A-P-O-L-E-O-N, same last name, R-E, V like in Victor, E-L-S dash, capital B-E-Y. So they could go on the Facebook page and, you know, we could talk or have some kind of conversation. It'd be great, you know. And thank you so much for having me on your radio.
Yeah,
I'm
great.
Honored to be on your radio. I'm honored to be in the Bay visiting my daughter, and my wife is here. I'm visiting the Grands, and we're having a great time out here in the Bay, and it's cool compared to New York.
All right. Well, good talking to you as well. It was great meeting you.
Thank you so much again, and have a great day, and I'm looking forward to speaking to you along the way. I hope we can see each other before I get out of here. Of course, I hope you come down.
All right, cool. Mm-hmm. You take good care.
Thank you so much. All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
All right, thank you, my sister. Peace.
So here is Napoleon Rebels Bay, Up You Mighty. Rebels Bay, and he has a concert coming up in a week, in a little bit of change, July 27th at Floyd Plenum's 57th Street Gallery. And we are joined in the studio by four of the directors, actors, producers that are part of the 10th Annual International Black Women's Film Festival, which is this weekend, Friday, Saturday. We're so happy to have you in the studio, all of you, on such short notice.
Thank you.
You all are calling from all over the place. New York, Atlanta, and and someone's in Southern California. No, that's not Southern California. No one's on the West Coast.
Yeah, I'm in the West Coast, Alessandra. I'm in the West Coast right now.
Oh, you are? Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So I'll just go around, and you can maybe tell our audience which film that you're going to be sharing with our audience, and if this is your first time participating in the International Black Women's Film Festival, which I'm really excited about. I'm so disappointed I'm going to be out of town. So we have, because I recognize Alfred Robbins' number, so welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Wanda. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and then Tiffany Black.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, totally. And we have Keisha Ansley.
Keisha is tied up on set. She wasn't able to make the call.
Oh, really? Okay. Who's telling me this?
This is Tiffany telling you.
Oh, you know each other. Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, she's the director of Call for Backup. I am the one of the producers and the starring actor in the film.
Oh.
And writer.
Oh, nice. And then is Alexandra Pinkston on?
Yes, that's me.
Okay, sure. And then there's one person whose name I didn't call, right?
Tamu Favorite.
Oh, Tamu, and you sent me a bio.
Yes,
same,
I did.
Yeah, and you got Harriet, as in Harriet Tubman Returns, right?
Exactly.
Oh, that one looks really fascinating. So why don't we start with you?
Okay, sure.
Yeah, why don't you tell us about your film and when it's screening, and you actually sent me a bio, and so did, thank you so much for sending me the press kit, Alfred.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Okay, so, Tamu.
Yes, sure. So Harriet Returns is screening on Saturday at 11:10 a.m., and it's basically, the premise is Harriet Tubman returns to modern times to emancipate two young rappers who use the N-word because Harriet believes that they have enslaved themselves. So her mission, her coming out of retirement, her mission is to emancipate them and set them free and put them back on the right track. And it is listed as a comedy, but it's not a comedy. So I don't know how that happened, but basically it's pretty dramatic. There is some funny moments in it, but it's pretty dramatic. Mm-hmm. And it's a 10-minute film.
Okay. And which film is this for you? Because you work in a lot of genres.
Right. Well, this is actually my first. I write mostly plays, and I wrote a full-length play, which I received 2 grants for, and I'm converting that into a full-length film. But this is one scene from that script, which we made into a short.
Mm-hmm. Are you talking about your 10 steps backwards, formerly
exactly.
known as the N-word?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. You mentioned in your bio that This particular piece was initially presented in a 10-minute performance of Women Speak, hosted by Andre DeShields.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let me read a little bit of your bio for our audience.
Sure.
You write that you're an African American writer on a mission to celebrate your rich culture by entertaining audiences with its history through stage and screen. Your work is based on facts with a goal to deliver a story through the common man and his dreams. And then you mentioned the 10 steps backwards. And you mentioned sort of where the piece was presented and all the awards you've received from it.
Right.
and then you mentioned, that you were working on converting it into a screenplay.
Exactly.
It was your short film, which we're going to be able to see on Saturday. And then you go on to talk about some of your other work, One Long Chain, which focuses on the history of jazz and blues, and is comprised of 7 vignettes. Got to Get to the Savoy, which was performed at the Manhattan Repertory Theater and the Harlem Swing Dance Society just last year.
Uh-huh.
And you participate in lots of writing workshops, and you received the Real, R-E-E-L, Sister Spirit Award, I guess, for this film?
Yes, for Harriet Returns.
That's amazing. So that's your first film, and you got the Real Sister Spirit Award. That's
Thank
impressive.
Thank you.
Ah.
Well, I believe it's the spirit of Harriet, who's working. So Harriet Tubman, who's basically moving it forward.
Right. And then you've done some work around AIDS awareness through the theater in Lesotho, Southern Africa?
Exactly. I worked in Johannesburg as well as Lesotho, and it's theater development, but the focus on AIDS development, yes.
Nice. That's great. That's really
great. Thank you.
Yeah. And mentioned Mr. Alfred Robbins, who's got the film The Next Day, and you're in the film too, right?
Yes, ma'am.
You're directing and you're in it.
Yeah, I figured I hired myself. You know, I knew I wouldn't cost much and I would show up on time, so I said, okay, you got the job.
Right. Well, you were born in Queens, New York. Do you know Tumu?
I do not. I would venture to say I'm probably older than she is.
Well, I don't know, but
but you all are. I mean, Tumu, aren't you in New York?
Well, I live in the Bronx, but of course, my circle of is basically Manhattan. You know, that's where I pretty much work, in Manhattan mostly. So, but I work a lot with the Frank Sevira and the Harlem Alliance. You know, places
okay.
like that.
Yeah.
And but I do play Harriet Tubman, just to throw that in.
You're in your movie too?
Yes.
That's really cool. And you are Mama Harriet. Wow. Really?
Yeah, it's an honor.
I love Sister Harriet and Sister Sojourner. So Mr. Robbins was born in Queens, New York. And
okay.
after completing his bachelor's degree at the State University of New York at Old Westbury, he began a career in the insurance industry. Oh, Yeah, Harriet might need some insurance. he later became interested in filmmaking and completed several short films. His first feature film, Grapes on a Vine, was nominated for Best Director, first feature film at the 2008 Pan-African Film Festival in Los Angeles, right?
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, that was a great opportunity, and I got a lot
yeah.
of exposure and got some really
yeah.
good feedback from people. So that was really, really a big deal. So shout out to Babu and the rest of the staff at the Pan-African Film Festival.
Yeah, they had a big one this year. What, aren't they like 25 years old or something now?
Yeah, he's been doing it for a while. And the thing that I'm so happy about for him is the fact that the festival, each year, it kind of has been growing exponentially. And, which is really a good thing for him. And because he does a lot of things for the filmmakers. Many other film festivals will have, they show your film, which is great. And I'm talking about some of the larger film festivals, but there are some resources they have access to that they don't really make available to you, where what Babu did for us is that he made sure that all of us went to the Directors Guild of America for a brunch, and we got an opportunity to see what it takes to get into DGA. We got a chance to meet Carl Weathers and Casey Lemons and some other notable directors just to, get a firsthand account of what it would take to be in a DGA. And they just really treated us very well. I think every filmmaker afterwards was like, wow, this is not the usual treatment you get. Even at the larger, more high-profile festivals, they don't do stuff like that. So I'm just really forever indebted to Fabu and the rest of the staff at Pan African Film Festival for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really awesome. Yeah, and in this film, Grapes on the Vine was acquired by the Urban Home Entertainment, and it was released at Walmart, Target, Best Buy, Redbox, and Blockbuster. That's awesome. So your film is out there. People can get it. It's probably at the public library now.
Yes, it's been everywhere. It's been in the barbershop. It's been in the hairdressing place. It's been in the, you know, the fast food place here in Atlanta, you know, in many other major cities. Bootlegging is a big deal. So when I say that, I'm really saying it kind of tongue-in-cheek because it's on bootleg. So you know you've made it when they start bootlegging your flick. So. You know, the funny thing is the day it was released to Blockbuster, literally the day it was released, and I live in Atlanta, somebody in New York that lives in Harlem called me, and she basically said the same thing. She said, "You've made it." I said, "Why?" She said, "Because they got your DVD bootlegged at the beauty salon already." I said, I'm done. I'm finished. I've reached the apex of my career.
Wow. So then you went, you finished, so you have Grapes on the Vine, and now you're, you know, you've got The Next Day. And you were hired recently, I guess 2011, to write and direct the feature film Raotet, which is was shot in Morocco and Washington, D.C., and the film is currently in post-production. So why don't we start with the last thing I said and then work our way back to The Next Day and then back to Grapes on the Vine, because I wanted to ask you The Next Day, thematic. I don't know what Grapes on the Vine is about, but I was wondering, are they really different stories?
They are completely different stories. Although I'm not you know, extremely young as a filmmaker, you know, being in my first film was in 2009. Mm-hmm. I think the most important thing you can discover as a filmmaker, the most important thing you can do is figure out what you're going to write about and make sure it's something you're passionate about and something that, you know, that you're writing from the gut. And the first film that I did was a project that was a lot of fun. But in terms of where it came from, it's a lot different than Raotet and a lot different than The Next Day. The Next Day was really very personal because basically it kind of chronicled the kind of life that I was living, as well as some other friends of mine were living that were single in the 30s here in Atlanta. And it was really just some things that we experienced that I wanted to tell in a truthful way, not in a Hollywood kind of way. And that was, you know, was really important to me to do that. So it really, you know, it was something I was very passionate about. And then when I got the opportunity to write and direct Raotet, that's based on a true story of a woman who is from Morocco, whose husband had the same name as the lead hijacker in the 9/11 attacks in New York. Mm. So what happened was, 5 days after 9/11, the first day that you were able to fly again, she went to the airport. She left the D.C., Baltimore area, flew into New York, and as soon as she got into New York, she was apprehended by the FBI and questioned for, I guess, 7 or 8 hours. And even thereafter, her life was just really a series of, you know, interrogations and investigations. I mean, everywhere she went, people knew that her husband had that name. And although they, you know, eventually found out that obviously her husband, who was actually a physician in the D.C. metro area, was not the pilot, but it affected her life greatly. She ended up getting a divorce. She was pregnant at the time. She ended up losing her child. But really, it was a great opportunity to, before we actually shot, I had to go to Morocco twice. The first time was literally just to get familiar with the culture and sit there and basically just watch people and, you know, just kind of see what the cultural differences were. And then, of course, we went back to cast and location scout, and we went back to shoot. So I spent probably a total of 3 months there, and when I tell you I feel at home at Morocco, I mean, I absolutely love Morocco. I mean, I was given a very warm welcome, and, you know, it was a great experience. But it was just funny because that was a bigger film than The Next Day. But The Next Day I was equally, if not more so, passionate about because it was chronicling, you know, my life and the life that I was living as a single guy here in Atlanta. You know, I had an opportunity in 2011 into 2012 to do two films I was really, really passionate about and really, you know, and the reason I say you need to be passionate about it because you're probably going to spend a year or two on your feature, whether it's promoting it or shooting it. So I would think it just makes sense that you really want to be passionate about something you're going to spend 2 years talking about. So I'm just thankful I had an opportunity to work on two projects that I am passionate about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know if our other guests are familiar with the story, but so I wanted to ask you, since you say that it's somewhat reflect your life. So, are you a daddy?
I am now. I am now. But basically, what the next day is about, it's about a guy that meets a young lady at a bar, at a club, which, you know, single people all over the country, all over the world. I mean, going to a bar to meet some, you know, to meet a woman if you're a guy, and meet a man if you're a woman, is that's been going on for, you know, forever. And but
or if you're a guy, depending on the bar, if you're a guy, you might want to meet a guy, or if you're a girl,
you might want to meet a guy and a woman. Exactly. So, but it's all, you know, in essence, it's all really the same thing. I mean, you're trying to make a connection with somebody. Mm-hmm. For me personally, you know, obviously, my friends and I, we were looking to make physical connections, you know, as quick as we could, preferably that night. So the next day we talk about what happened the night before, how successful were you? And that's a universal thing, I think. But when you engage in a relationship like that, if you can call it a relationship, one of the things you obviously don't know is who the other person is and what life experiences they have, which would make being in a relationship of any kind with them, anything beyond the day, would make it problematic, to say the least. So the next day, what happens is this guy gets, you know, he has a one-night stand with this young lady, and ultimately what happens is the next morning, after misunderstanding about the circumstances under which they met, he kind of feels obligated. Well, you know, let me at least take her out one time, let her know that, you know, I'm really a decent guy. Just, you know, I'm not just some guy that just every night goes to bars and tries to pick up women, even though that's what he tries to do. So ultimately, they go out on a real date, decide not to see each other anymore, and then 3 months later, she shows up at his house pregnant. And that's really where the narrative really takes off, because, of course, anybody that's done that, and most single guys know that if you date somebody, you know, a couple of times and you don't see them for a while, you know, conventional wisdom would tell you, well, you know, in this 3 months I haven't seen you, I don't know what you've been doing. And so what you begin to learn about each of the characters as the story unfolds, because once he finds out this young lady's pregnant, the way he responds to it, it's kind of an indication that there's some things going on in his life, that, you know, he had some dysfunctional issues in his family, and you see about that, and you see these some issues that she had, they both are affected by the, you know, the aspects and experiences that the other had in their life. In a way that, you know, it's almost in some cases it can almost be life threatening, and you kind of see this in a real way. And that was so interesting to me. What people have said to me is that this is a real story about real people. Like, people have said to me, like, that's my life, that's what I experienced. So I was really glad to put it on screen in a way that wasn't necessarily Hollywood. For instance, many movies you'll go to, you know, people are regular middle-class people, but most middle-class people I know, majority of them don't live in mansions, don't drive, you know, Jaguars and Escalades. I mean, some do, but majority don't. But I wanted to make a movie about real people living the life the way that, you know, people I knew were living it. And, you know, based on the response that people have, I've had to, you know, the film, for the few that have seen it, it's, you know, it's. I think we did that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is feature film, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And when is the screening?
It's screening Saturday at 1:45 at the main San Francisco Library. I believe it's 100 Larkin Street.
That's right.
1:45 on Saturday, July 21st, 100 Larkin Street. 1:45, be there. It's
right,
free.
Yeah, yeah, that is really awesome. So, Alessandra, tell us about The Testament of Karma.
Yeah, it's a suspense thriller, and it's basically it's about
thriller.
A woman.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's scary. But I play the main character, and the character, her name is Carmen. She wakes up in her own house under a bathtub filled with water. She has no idea what she's doing there, and then she wakes up to find that there is a man who's actually in the house who's taunting her. She can't get out of the house, can't get out the doors, can't get out the windows, and the man is chasing her through the house. And it's a twist at the end. She finds out what the guy is doing there, exactly what's going on. So it's one of those movies you definitely have to see, you definitely have to pay attention to. But, yeah, it's definitely scary and suspenseful.
Wow, yeah. So tell us about your road to The Testament. Is this your first film? Yeah.
It's the first film that I created. I co-directed it, I wrote it, and I'm starring in it as well, produced it.
So I was very hands-on with it, very hands-on, and luckily I had a great cast and crew who was there to support me, and it was really great. Everyone there was very professional. It was really, really great, great time, great experience.
Mm-hmm. And how do you come to filmmaking?
Well, actually, I've been an actress for quite some time now, and the reason why I actually came up with this film is a lot of the roles that I were getting a lot of women in my age group, they were really just those kind of roles where you're just staying there and you just say the lines and you look pretty. There was no depth. There was no character. And so I wanted to create roles for women that did have character and who did have some kind of depth to it. So this is just the beginning. I'm actually working on a feature-length science fiction and an action flick right now. So I'm actually just trying to create more roles for women where you're not just standing there and just looking pretty. There's a lot of roles that we get.
Nice, yeah. So where do you call home?
I call home Chicago.
Okay.
I'm actually from Chicago. Currently I'm residing in Los Angeles, but my film is actually going to be at the Black Harvest Film Festival this year as well in August.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be August 4th and August 9th at 8:30, so I'm going to be flying home to Chicago to support it there as well.
Okay. It's called Black Harvest?
Yeah, the Black Harvest Film Festival in Chicago.
Oh, that sounds nice. So is it a black film festival, or is it just called Black Harvest?
No, it's mostly for black filmmakers. Yeah, it's for black filmmakers. Yeah.
Oh, that Chicago is one of those, like, you know, people think about New Orleans as that's where our roots are. People think about Chicago,
oh, yeah.
Like, ooh, that, there's so much in Chicago, so much history, so much of our culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, nice. Did you go to school for acting, or did you start out, you know, selling insurance or something?
No, I actually got my degree in journalism. But I've been acting since I was a little girl. So I've always taken my acting lessons and been in my plays and even other short films and other feature-length films that were independent. So, yeah, this is my first one, but it's more to come, so I'm very excited about it.
Yeah. So I presume since you have a writing background that it was – and you're also an actress, that
yes.
was the movement from, you know – the type of writing that you might have done as a journalist and the type of writing, you know, being on the other side of the script, you know, doing the lines as opposed to writing the lines. I know screenplays are different from plays, you know, that we write, that, you know, people write for the theater, but there are some crossover there. Did you find your preparation that it helped you there? And then so what were some of the challenges of writing a screenplay and casting? And then I don't see how you all could, like, be in the film, too. That seems really difficult, like shifting, you know, so like, okay, I'm acting now, and then I'm the director, too, so you have to do what I say. But then I'm like you, sort of.
Yeah. Yeah, you know what? It's a lot of hard work. Luckily, I grew up writing short stories and plays, and then I had actually written a couple of feature-length films prior to I actually got this one made. So I had experience with it. But, yeah, transitioning from the actress to being the writer, the director, and the producer, it's so much hard work. And I actually spoke with someone who did that prior to I even went and did this, and they said, you know, they're like, you're going to have to focus more on one. You're going to, you know, it's not going to be easy. And they explained everything to me, and it was not. It was very tough, but like I said, luckily I had people there who were very supportive of me. So they made the transition easier for me, but it was definitely a lot of hard work. But I would do it again in a heartbeat.
Yeah, I just chime in. It's extremely, extremely, extremely difficult because if
yeah.
you're going to give a convincing performance, you can't, you know, you can't be in the scene worrying about anything else but what you're doing. But
right.
as a director, as you all know, I mean, worrying about everything is kind of like that's part of your job description. so you kind of have to turn that off when you're in the scene. But I was very fortunate because two of the producers, and I'm going to really highlight them because this is an International Black Women's Film Festival, Deanna Dawn, who's really the star of the film, and Charlene Falls, who executive produced it, it was really helpful that, one, I'd worked with them before, and two, they both have, you know, pretty extensive experience in industry. This is a really, 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 underlying really small film. I mean, in terms of it may not look like it on screen, but many times in the scene, if there was myself and Deanna, it was myself, Deanna, and the cameraman, and that was really it. I mean, it was really small. So it was really, you know, incumbent upon everybody involved that they really had to understand what their job was. This was going to be no frills. It wasn't like Ralph Todd where I actually had, you know, we had assistants, we had crew around. So, you know, as you can all attest to, it's when you're working with, when you're in the film, when you're directing, as well, you really, really have to have people around you that are supportive and really know what they're doing, because you can't give the full attention to them, the way you would if you were not in the film. So, I think we probably will, I think, you know, I just speak for anybody else here, but we probably all were very fortunate that we worked with good people, because to be in, to direct a film and then act in one, you know, and act in it as well, if you don't have the right crew around you, could probably be a disaster. But I'm just really glad that I had Deanna and Charlene around, and of course the actors, like some of my actors, like Roger Mitchell and Priska Outland, who's going to be there, and you know Hazel Duwall, LaShawn Butler, Christopher Martin, everybody who was involved had prior experience and kind of understood we were working with. So I was really fortunate.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome shout out to the DP, Derek Owens. What's up, Derek? I know he's listening.
Yes, Alessandra, why don't you talk about your, the other actors and the people that made this particular feature possible.
Yes, my co-star, Montel Harvey, he was absolutely amazing. I actually was the casting director for the film as well. Mm-hmm. And I interviewed a lot of people, and they were all great, but it was like he just came in and he just delivered. Like, as soon as he, like, started reading, it was just amazing. And then we also had Keenan Lockett. This is his first film as well. He's in the film. And then the person who actually co-directed with me was Houston Williams Jr. So they were just so amazing. Like I said, it was professional. We had a few bumps in the road, but other than that, it went pretty smoothly. So like I said, this is definitely something I would do again. I'm excited to get back on set again with the action film that I'm writing right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really something. So you go from thriller to action film. You know, it's like,
yeah.
You know, when one thinks about, oh, you're pretty. I just pulled up your bio.
Thank you.
Didn't she say she's normally on set looking pretty? Isn't that her that said that? Okay, so yeah, it would stand to reason that she's pretty. I would expect nothing more.
Thank you.
Yeah, people can see you in on the Discovery Channel and Style Network and Animal Kingdom.
Yeah.
And you just completed a national Hershey commercial and voiceover work for State Farm Insurance. Might be changing from the one I've got to yours. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, and also, let's see, your last play is in the choral poem Pieces,
yes.
And it's a dynamic play that combines theater, poetry, and rap.
Yes.
And your play is set to tour Southern California in the fall of this year. Oh, send that to me. My mother's in L.A. Maybe I could pop down and see it.
I definitely will. I rap the entire time of the play.
Wow, that's amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you can also be seen in the webisode Six Roots, which is currently being advertised on BET and TNT. What's Six Roots about?
It's actually it's a dramatic webisode. It's about a bunch of characters and all of their stories intertwine. Mm-hmm. And I play the character of Tay. I have a girlfriend and I'm cheating on her with my ex-girlfriend. And basically, at one point, we're just going to all get into it. It's really, really great the way it was written and the way all the stories are going to intertwine. So when that comes out, I definitely recommend checking that out too. I really had a blast. Having being an actress on that set as well.
Okay, cool. Thank you. Well, Tiffany.
I'm here.
Yeah, I know. You've been waiting a while, and thank you for your patience. Call for backup.
Call for backup.
We need to call for backup. What is that? Call for backup. Sounds
call
like something
backup.
We need to, like, have on our phone, you know, you have your emergency, you can press this, and if your phone's not working, you can call for help. What
you
know
that's
about?
Exactly what you need with this character, Strandelica. It's about a pop star this international pop star who cannot sing, and she's a recording artist, and she's selling a quadrillion amount of records, and she cannot sing. And it's the irony around mass media and what people kind of buy into these days.
Wow, that's interesting. I can think of a lot of artists that can't sing that are making a lot of money.
You know, like that's what's so funny about it. People, like, you know, they are so certain that I'm talking about one person, but I'm not. But it's very funny that even in thinking I'm talking about one person, everybody has a different person that they think that this film is about. And it's not about any one particular character. It's, you know, a combination of people that I actually like, whether they can sing or not. That's, you know, debatable, but the music works anyway. So, you know, we listen to it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so you going to drop some names right now for us?
Of names of what?
People that are calling for backup.
I won't say. I can say who I base the main character around, which is the artist that I like. Of course, Beyonce's at the top of the list because she is queen of all. I think Gaga is definitely a very original artist. She brings a lot of I think when she first came out, she had a lot of different dynamics that made her interesting, but we didn't lose that strong vocal performance that you often lose with, like, pop stars who are selling so many units. So between those two and Prince, really, I'm a big Prince fan, so I had to record a few songs for the film. We made a little soundtrack, and those are the three artists that I kind of relied upon the most. But at the time that I wrote the film, I was listening to their music the most.
So which film is this for you, and when is your film screening at the festival?
This is my first film as a writer and executive producer. I've done some, I produced a few more short films since this, but this film started off as a stage play, and we converted it over, and I hooked up with Keisha, who is absolutely remarkable. She's a DGA training in a very competitive program, so she's tied on set right now. But this is not her first film. She went to film school, so I think this is like maybe her fifth, but this is my first one writing. But I've done, of course, a few other indie projects as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And we're screening on Saturday the 21st at 11:20 a.m. at the festival.
Okay. Yeah, I was looking at did a search for your name, and are you a songwriter?
It's tough. I mean, I wrote the songs for the film.
Yeah.
And the main song, "Cloud of My Heart." It's available on iTunes and Spotify if you just want to listen to it. But I take it very seriously, and they're catchy. I listen to them, you know, when I'm writing. So we like Cloud of My Heart, and there's a music video also for Call for Backup. So if you go on YouTube, you can see music videos for both of them. It was a really, really fun project, and I learned a lot about the recording process. And, I mean, you don't really have to be able to sing. With technology these days and auto-tuning and other types of post-production tricks, you can make yourself sound like just about whoever you want to. So, you know, I have a lot of respect for recording artists, but I think that it may be something that is more of a quality that we buy into and not particularly a voice.
Yeah. So what about when, you know, when you're not in the First World Nation and your electricity is iffy like it is a lot of places? Or what if you're in a First World Nation and you're in California and we have what's called rolling blackouts, or you're in New York and you just don't have any electricity for whatever reasons? Remember that? So what do you do when you are not, like, you don't know how to sing, you can't play an instrument, and you were dependent on all that technology? What happens when the technology is not battery operated and there's no backup because we need to eat, not listen to you?
You know what? You wouldn't want to listen to the main character in this film, no, because that will have you desiring so much more. But these days, we have so much more to lean on. And I think that's what we like to that's what this film kind of focuses on. We call it like the $1 million song and the $10 voice. And it's such a popular thing that continues to happen. You have celebrities that aren't acting or singing, and they're still, you know, getting so many views. And you have recording artists who aren't singing, but they are selling records. And you have personalities that are in films, but they're not really acting. So, I mean, more and more these days, we buy into different elements of talent, whether it's just looks or some other type of star quality or appeal. And that's what we're kind of gauging or trying to delve into with this project. And I think that it may just withstand the test of time. So I'm excited about it. I'm glad to see that it's still doing well with the festivals and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So is it a 2011 release or 2012?
We went to another festival last year, so we finished it just last year. But, I mean, we are still doing a festival run, and I think you kind of have at least a year or two span. I think I may have seen the Harriet Tubman at the Hollywood Black Film Festival last year. So
yeah, absolutely. We were there.
Right, yeah, I saw that film. It was really, really cute.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
It might have been in our blog, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so do you have a website for people that are interested in you know, following you and finding out more about Call for Backup?
Absolutely. My website is www.tiffanysblack.com. And Keisha's website is under construction. She's working on her next film, which is Save Jesus Washington Saves the World. And, I mean, we're available on social media. Facebook me, Tiffany Black, it's all the same.
Mm-hmm. Did you say her film was called Jesus Washington Saves?
Yeah, her film, her upcoming film is called Jesus Washington Saves the World. And
it's a
really cute film. Yeah, it is. And it lives up to the title. It's a very grand name and a grand film. But it's about a young boy who witnesses a crime, and it inspires him to save his neighborhood and ultimately the world.
Oh, that sounds great. That's really great. So where do you hail from? Where do you call home?
I call St. Petersburg, Florida, home. I live between there and Los Angeles. We made the film in Los Angeles, but I am currently in transition to relocate to Atlanta for the fall because the entertainment and filming is really popping over there. So I'm going to go over there and see, you know, what I can dig my fingers into before I head back to Los Angeles for pilot season. So I'm kind of all over.
Oh, yeah. So do you know Alfred? Do you know his work?
I do not know Alfred, but I did hear his interview, and it sounds like somebody I need to get into.
Oh, yeah, totally.
I can definitely plug you into some people down here. So you're going to be at the festival, I imagine, on Saturday, right?
I'm not going to be at the festival.
Oh,
I'm in Florida right now, yeah.
Okay, well, my email address, and I don't think I'm not going to get in trouble by giving out over the air like this. It's al@botnfilms.com, al@botnfilms.com. So just shoot me an email, and, you know, if you need anything, I'll certainly do whatever I can to, you know, connect you with some people here to see if, you know, it doesn't kind of...
Are you on Facebook? What's your last name?
I am. Robbins, R-O-B-B-I-N-S. And also you can look for me, or you can just look up The Next Day on Facebook, on The Next Day at Twitter.
Tiffany,
okay, cool.
I've got
yeah.
it. I can send it to you.
Oh, fantastic. Thank
yeah,
you.
Networking on
welcome.
The air. Great. we are out of time, though. So I wanted to I want to go around again and let everyone have an opportunity. Tamu, since you went first, you have been really quiet.
I'm listening.
Okay. Yeah, I want to give you an opportunity, you know, to you know, say a few more words. And before that, though, I have a question for you, Alfred. Grapes and Vine, I didn't have a chance to look that up. And I wondered what is it about? And as you said, the films are all different. The one that you went to Morocco for is different from the film that you're going to be sharing with us The Next Day. And that's a really, really nice visual of the backs of the couple. You know,
right.
on your film, the back of the woman and the back of the man.
Thank you. Yeah, Derek Owens, the director of photography, was actually his idea. He actually took the photograph that we took to a graphic arts person to have it done. So Derek gets the credit for that. But yeah, Grapes on a Vine was about a man and a woman who were married. They want to have children, and the woman is unable to have children. And ultimately, he goes to great lengths to have a son. I don't know if I really want to go further because then I'll give up the whole.
No, you don't have to.
The whole story, but that's basically what it's about, and it's a drama, but it, you know, there's some funny moments in there, and there's some people, a couple people in it you probably recognize, Greg Allen Williams, who, you know, back in the day he was the black guy on Baywatch, but since then he's been in Remember the Titans, he's on Necessary Roughness, he played the father on The Game, and also Jasmine Lewis, who her claim to fame, I guess, would be He Can Play That Game, as well as playing Ice Cube's wife in the Barbershop series.
Wow.
And if I might, I forgot to mention one person in the next day, Yakini Horn, who plays Macy Hansen. Some of you may recognize Yakini from the ABC Sunday night movie that came out this year called Firelight, and she was also in an episode of Necessary Roughness, and we have Roger Mitchell in it, who was featured in Battle L.A., and he's going to be in a movie with Denzel Washington, upcoming film called Flight, and he was also played the mayor of Charlotte in the TNT movie The Hornet's Nest, and then of course Deanna Dawn, most of you will recognize from the Lifetime movie The Fantasia Barrino Story, Life is Not a Fairy Tale. She played Fantasia's good friend, I believe her name was Ruby. So I just wanted to make sure I got that little PSA in there.
Sure, no problems. Like, you're just dropping names like, you know, crystals. Like,
well,
whoa,
yeah, I was lucky.
Yeah.
These people worked with me because it wasn't because I threw money at them, because there was no money to throw at them. They worked, you know, and Atlanta is, it's big but it's small, and I got to know these people, and we became friends, and that's how I was able to get them to work with me, because, you know, very often, you know, these actors that have been, or these, you know, they've worked on major stuff, and then to come on our set, it's like we have no assistance, we have no trailer. We will have, you know, we're not going to have a gourmet chef preparing meals, and they didn't care. They just wanted to work. So that's why I kind of feel like I have to keep, you know, I just want people to know this, because, you know, as all the other filmmakers on the, you know, I'm sure could attest to, is that it's great to work with great people, but if you, some, you know, every now and then, if you have a crew member or a cast member that's not really very happy, it can sometimes cause a problem on set, which can affect the production. I didn't have any of those problems, and I would venture to say that, you know, I'm not going to speak for anybody else, but I would imagine since you all completed your projects and you're in festivals, you probably didn't have that problem either. So that's why I wanted to highlight these other people. And one more thing, and I'm going to be done with my long winded this year. If you miss the next day at the International Black Women's Film Festival, you can catch it August 10th and 11th at the Black Harvest Film Festival in Chicago. You can go to Cisco Film Festival.
Oh, you're
going to
be there too. Oh, nice.
Yes, I will. So, yeah, so I'll see you there. So for both of our films, what is the name of your film again? It's going to be
The Testament of Karma. The Testament of Karma. The Testament of Karma.
Right, you can go to, I think it's the CiscoFilmCenter.org, and you get all information about both of our films. And then if you miss that one, you can catch the next day here in Atlanta, August 16th, 5:30, at the W Hotel. It's going to be the finalist at the Peachtree Village International Film Festival. You can go to pviff.com. Okay, I'm done.
Well, I'm glad you have a website.
Oh, actually, one more thing. Yes, we do have a website for the film. It's bokmfilms.blogspot.com. We're also on Facebook, and we're on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is really, really extraordinary. And Tiffany, you definitely need to hook up with this guy, because he is very, 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 very well connected.
Yeah, I've made a lot of mistakes. I'm sorry, not to cut you off. I've made a lot of mistakes, and one of the things that I kind of commission myself to do is anything I know, I'm not gonna hoard it. I'm gonna share it. So if anybody wants to email me, has any questions about anything, I don't look. I'm not Spike Lee. I don't claim to. You know, I obviously haven't reached the highest heights in filmmaking, but if there's anything I've said that may be of interest to you, if there's anything that you, if you look at my bio, or anything you think that I might know or I might be able to help you with, please email me or something. I would love to help people, because I don't want to see people make the same mistakes I did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is really wonderful. That is really wonderful that, you know, that you want to share, you know, what you've learned, you know, with other other perspective, you know, directors and writers and actors and people that want to work, you know, other aspects of the film industry. So, Tamu.
Yes, I'm still here.
Yeah, I was wondering, gosh, I was supposed to play something, but I think I might end up having to broadcast this another time because we're, like, so running out of time. I wanted to ask you, maybe you might have, in your closing remarks to me, you can say what you wanted to say, but I was wondering if you might want to talk about sort of the whole idea of black women making films and about, you know, having our faces, you know, sort of on the screen and sort of what that does, you know, for our community, what that does to the industry. And I know there are a lot of difficulties, you know, after the film festival, okay, where is the distribution?
Right.
You know, where are the houses? Where are we going to see this again? And a lot of people are going, you know, to, you know, using the, internet, you know, as a place to be able to give, you know, their films a life. And I think, I'm trying to think, is it you? Are you the one that, the director that has, you're in a series? Oh, no, maybe it's Alexander.
Well, I could say that my director is Marquis Smalls, and he has quite a few. I think this is his ninth film.
Okay.
And so he's doing a great job with that, and he's, you know, working, you know, moving forward. But as far as, and I really appreciate his work because he was very creative. And as far as women, I'm basically the writer, executive producer, and the caterer, and all this stuff going on with the film. Because it was challenging as far as making the film. And then also turning around and playing Harriet. I had like 1 hour of sleep, and then we shot it in one day. So it was challenging. But the bottom line is, I think it's imperative that women are involved in filmmaking because it gives us more of a voice. And also we need to... you know, really stand tall as far as on the business aspect of making films. It's very important that we do research and figure out what works and what doesn't work. And I encourage more women to get involved. And as an actor, you know, I figured, well, you know what, I'm not working as much as I like, you know, and so I definitely want to create more work, not only for myself, but for more women of color. Is one of my goals as a writer.
And who else is on your creative team for this film? You mentioned
Greg Adair, Ken Cavett, Siddiqui's last name, I'm sorry, Dwayne, you know, these are the two guys that plays the two young guys. And then Chris Dubrock was our music. He basically did the music for the film. It's a lot of people creatively involved. Gia Lamont, she basically did the wardrobe part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and do you have a website for your film or for yourself?
I'm actually going to create one. My sister is writing my back about that, so I'm going to create one this weekend.
Right. Yeah. And did someone mention, or did you mention that your film is also going to be screening of elsewhere after this weekend?
Yeah, we're going to be in Chicago, you know, as well. And my director told me, and I was looking for it, I'm assuming it's The Black Harvest because it's in Chicago in August. So I'm assuming it's the same one. This would be, basically, we're on our 14th festival.
Our goal is
to be in the festival every month.
Okay.
So we've been pretty much meeting that goal.
Oh, well, they're not enough months to be in a festival. So you're surpassing your goal. You're doing like multiple festivals.
Right. Our first was last August. You know, the Martha's Vineyard was our first one last August, and then we kept going from there.
Wow, that's impressive. Well, that's great. That's really
Yeah. So the more exposure we get, and then the goal is to basically be able to get the full length produced. That's the idea, and I don't want to produce it myself. So the more exposure Harriet Returns get, then the easier it would be to get the full length produced. That's the goal.
Yeah. Are you going to be in the San Francisco Bay Area for the festival this weekend?
Unfortunately, I won't be. But my sister will be there representing us. Yes.
Okay. Is your sister in the film?
No, she's not. She won't. Her name is Mona Lisa Favorite Hill, but she won't. She's not in the film, but she definitely can easily represent me. So she knows.
Oh, nice. Alessandra, is that how you say it, Alessandra?
Yes, it's Alessandra.
Alessandra. So, closing thoughts, further thoughts, and are you going to be present this weekend at the festival?
No,
Unfortunately, I'm not, and I'm really sad about that. But you can check out my movie. It's going to be this Saturday at 11:40 a.m. And then my website is actually kindredquestfilms.com. You can go there and check out the trailer. And then you can follow me on Twitter at kindredq as well.
Okay. And Tiffany.
Yes.
You want to have the last word?
Thank you so much for having me, Ms. Wanda. I appreciate it. And all of my information about Call for Backup and all of my other projects are available at www.tiffanysblack.com.
Well, thank you all so much. It's been really lovely.
Thank you.
And your work sounds like, wow, just so phenomenal. So y'all can send me links so I can watch this. I'm not going to be in town this weekend, and I don't think I'm going to be able to make it to Chicago, but that sounds like a really great film festival. Black Harvest, what a nice name. And Marcus Garvey's birthday is on the 17th. Wow, that's really fabulous. And it is actually a harvest season that's coming around, like August, right? If one was doing sort of the agrarian thing, isn't that like harvest season, harvest time?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm embarrassed to say.
City people, huh? Okay.
Exactly.
All right. Well, congratulations and good luck on you know your films having life after these festivals, and looking forward to seeing them, you know, on the marquees and saying, oh, I talked to that person on my radio show. I'm so excited. So, anyway.
Thank you, and good luck with your work as well.
All right, thank you. You all take
care. Thank you for having me, Wanda. I appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Oh, you're welcome. Peace and blessings.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. So we are going to start our interview with the wonderful actor, James Jerome, who, as I mentioned, was a part of the Scottsboro Boys, currently at ACT in San Francisco. It was extended, so it's through this coming weekend. It was supposed to close last weekend, and it was held over, and so it is having a terrific run. Again, that's the Scottsboro Boys and James T. Lane, James Tyrone Lane, and I had a great conversation last week, and I've had a lot of mixed feelings about this particular play and the story and the content and the way it's presented. But I have no hesitation about the wonderful conversation that I had with this remarkable actor who I really enjoyed seeing on stage for this play, which looks at a really significant trial in American judicial history. And, I mean, it's like I don't think any other trial, have been any other trials quite like this one, you know, putting children in prison, the trial lasting, you know, cumulatively probably over 30 years, and no reparations for the injustice that these men experienced, collectively known as the Scottsboro Boys, even though, you know, of course, they ended up coming of age in behind bars. So I'm going to play this interview, and it's in three parts, and we're going to actually complete the last part when we go off the air, because it is about 55 minutes long, and certainly worth your while listening to. So here is James T. Lane talking about the Scottsboro Boys and his role as, again, as he plays the role of Ruby, and that's one of the women that accused the men of the boys and then men of rape, and he also plays Ozzie Powell, who is a 15, and he was born to an abusive father who left the family when Ozzie was a small boy. And Ozzie worked odd jobs, and at 14 he ran away from home and bounced from highway camps to sawmills for weeks or months at a time until he ended up on that train platform that fateful day. And the rest is the story of the Scottsboro Boys. So why don't we start out, James T. Lane. You play Ozzy Powell and some others.
Yeah.
So why don't you talk about...
Ozzy Powell.
Ozzy. Oh, thank you. Ozzy Powell.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just thinking about Ozzy Powell. That he's a true hero, you know?
How do you mean?
I think because he is the only one that resists in a real concrete way the injustice that's happening to them. They've been, I don't know, China, you can tell us when, because there were 9 trials, right? Or are they 10?
Just about.
Yeah, and I don't know which trial this was and which transport to what prison or to what courtroom from or to that this happens. But he was just like, all righty now, you're talking about us like we're not human beings, that we can't hear you, that we don't, you know, I mean, we're not getting the same consideration that a furniture gets.
Yeah, you know, he at that point, you know, he had just been fed up. You know, he had just been tired of you know, these authority figures taking and, you know, just running over them like they aren't, you know, human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And he just really couldn't take it anymore. And, you know, it kind of differs from the actual story. He did, in fact, you know, pull a gun and attack the guard, but it kind of happened in a different way. They were in a car, and he was in the back seat of the car, and the officer was in the front seat, and we played. We're on in a bus, and it's a lot of us. But you know, you're totally right. Where he's just, you know, was just fed up, and you know, of course, Haywood, you know, escaped from jail and did a lot of other things that, you know, that also stood up. But I think it was just kind of like a combination between I'm just not going to take it anymore, and I'm just going to have to do something about this situation because it's driving me insane, you know.
Right.
So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're right. You know, Haywood does, you know, he does run away and he stays gone for a bit. However, I think with Ozzy, it's what he does is for the whole group. Because if he was successful, then... Now he wouldn't have been the only one free, and whereas you know Haywood, I think the way he's portrayed, I think he is certainly you know, not just thinking of himself, but when you leave, you know, when you escape as an individual, everyone's not escaping. You're only escaping, and if you took everybody with you, you might not be successful necessarily.
We think
about, you know, Harriet Tubman, and you know, he was not Harriet Tubman, but we can think about her and why she is so wonderful, and why we think about her in such a way is that going, like, she's free, and then she goes back to get her family. Like, what?
Oh, yeah.
And then she goes back again, like 17 times. Like, oh my God, if she just went back once, that would have been something. And then she, you know, she, when she has them escape, you know, escaping from enslavement, which, you know, prison is enslavement, you know, they change their minds, like, no, hold up, you can't go back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so and then the way that Ozzy is portrayed, you know, in the literature, you know, he's portrayed as one that is not really smart. And I was wondering if you could talk about sort of just the whole way that the young men, you know, the 9 Scottsboro boys, how they're rated by their IQs and about, I mean, all the stuff. Oh, this one here, you know, he was nearsighted and he was going to find, you know, get glasses. Like, wow, and that's amazing, you know, that there was no medical care. That he couldn't get glasses.
Oh, yes, at that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you know, just the conditions, you know, and, you know, Willie, you know, had syphilis before he even got there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and how, you know, really bad case and wasn't treated. And,
and that's treatable.
You know, yeah, you know, and it's just, you know, we were barely considered human beings,
mm-hmm.
you know, at that time. And, you know, and the simple fact that, you know, they were all lumped together called the Scottsboro Boys, you know, it's like only, you know, later on do we find out so much more about them, and when they wrote the books and stuff like that, do we find out so much more about them. But they were just known as the Scottsboro Boys then. They had no individual identities, you know, and just, you know, thrown into the group, you know. And I think this play is so important because we do get to see, you know, we could get to see what happened to Ozzy, and you know, you know his name. You know, they didn't have any names then. You know, they were just the Scottsboro Boys, but you get to find out, you know, what Eugene, you know, what happened to Eugene, or, you know, you just get more of their backstories as we tell this story. And it's just so important. The individual is important. Every individual is important. And that's an overall message that everybody matters. You know, we all matter. You know, you can't do me like you done me, you know, like you did us before. You know, we all matter, and we're not going to take it anymore. So it's an amazing, amazing story, and bringing these characters to life individually, as a black man in musical theater, it has been wonderful because you know, you get you know, you all end up in the chorus, and you're just, you know, one of many in the chorus. You know, or unless you get the opportunity to get a starring role in something or a leading role in a show. But then there's usually just one or two of us, you know. But this show, we all get to shine, and we all have names, and we all, you know, get to do what we do so well, whether we tap well or sing well or act well or dance well. You know, we all get featured, and we all have names, you know, in the program. Right. Which is very, very important.
Right. Yeah. So tell my audience how you came to the Scottsboro Boys on stage, and how you came to Ozzy and the other characters that you portray, and how you shift in and out of them so well.
Thank you. Well, first off, you know, with the creation of the play, the musical by John Kander and Fred Ebb and Susan Stroman and David Thompson, they are the writers and the music writers and lyric writers and the book writer, and Susan Stroman is the director and the choreographer. You know, they have a process where they go through writing, and then they, you know, creating the music and the book, and then they have these things called readings where, you know, you put it up on its feet with, you know, music stands and scripts and some music, and you hear how it sounds, and you invite an audience, and, you know, you see what works and what doesn't work. You throw this out, you change these characters, you add more, you take away things. And I was involved in the first time that I auditioned for a reading, I totally bombed my audition. And what happened, I you know, you were just required to sing 16 bars of a song, and which usually means you have to cut, you have to make a cut in a song that you want to sing. And the piano player and I, you know, did not get together well on the cuts, and he played something else, so I ended up really bombing that audition. So they did a reading, and it was fabulous, and I heard about it, and so they were going to do another reading, and I said, you know what, I'm going to sing my whole song. I really got to get into this show. What attracted me was it was a story about black men, you know, and musical theater, and I hadn't ever had that experience before to tell the story and to work with so many of my contemporaries all at the same time. Like I said, it's usually one or two of us in the show. So it seemed like a very exciting project. So I went in for the audition for the second reading, and I booked the job, and that reading happened the June of 2009, I believe. And this is how I kind of remember the date, because I think that was the year that Michael Jackson passed away. And we were in rehearsals for the reading when I got the news that he passed away. And he's also, you know, he's a very, you know, as with a lot of people who are in the arts and even African Americans, you know, he was, you know, such a strong force in entertainment, you know. So I felt extremely honored and humbled at the same time and grateful to be doing a show that highlighted so much of the Black experience, and to be an entertainer in you know, as an African American at that time, you know, at the time of his passing. So it was pretty remarkable time for me. Mm-hmm. So we put together, we did the showing of the reading, and then they announced that it was going to Broadway. And now at the time I was in Chicago, the musical on Broadway. And yeah. So, and which is also another Candor and Ebb musical.
Right.
So, yeah.
Hello? So, why don't we start out, Jay? So, here we continue. We got disconnected. So, here is James picking up his thought. Okay.
Well, like I said, it was I did a first reading of the Scottsboro Boys the summer of 2009, mm-hmm. where Michael Jackson passed away. I think I got through that part.
Yes.
And I was still in the production of Chicago, the musical on Broadway, and I didn't want to, you know, when they announced later on that they would be doing a production of the Scottsboro Boys at the Vineyard, mm-hmm. I couldn't justify leaving Chicago, the musical on Broadway, to do the Scottsboro Boys at the Vineyard. It just didn't make economical sense. And so they got picked up at the Vineyard, and then they were going to the Guthrie out in Minnesota, and then they announced that it was going to Broadway. So I was really like, oh no, I missed the boat, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I got a call after they were finished at the Guthrie asking if I was still involved, I mean still wanted to be involved in the production. So you know, so I did a little bit of double duty in Chicago, the musical on Broadway, while I was rehearsing the Scottsboro Boys,
mm-hmm.
and eventually went into the Broadway company. And with this production, as you saw, you know, we play many, many characters, you
yes.
know. Some of us play up to three or four different characters. I play Ozzie Powell, which is one of the Scottsboro Boys,
mm-hmm.
and I also play Ruby Bates,
mm-hmm.
which Ruby Bates and Victoria Price were the accusers of the boys. They accused the boys of raping them, and it was all just a lie. It was, you know, so that they could get out of. They were two prostitutes on the train, and they didn't want to get arrested, so they Victoria thought of this idea of accusing these boys of rape, and there you have the story, mm-hmm. basically. So
yeah, and it was really interesting, digressing a minute, the law that if a white woman accuses a black man of rape, her word is enough evidence that it is true.
Absolutely.
He has no recourse.
Absolutely, you know, what white says goes, you know, especially at that time. You know, and in subsequent trials after that, they did, you know, they did actually test Victoria and to see if she had been raped, but they couldn't find, you know, they couldn't find anything that was of any value or whatever. But you know, it was such a crazy time. Like you said, you know, if you were white, you were right.
Mm-hmm.
And but it's also an amazing time because it, you know, it predates all of the civil rights stuff, you know, in terms of that movement. Mm-hmm. But it kind of started it. It galvanized a lot of people who wanted to get into action. You know, the folks from the North. You know, the Jewish folks. You know, it started. You know. a real kind of like, we're not going to take it anymore. It, like I said, it predates the civil rights movement, but it really got a lot of people involved, and you could smell the change in the air, you know, and the Scottsboro Boys trial was definitely a part of all of that.
Yeah, because it went on forever. I mean, you know, the thing, the incident happened in 1931, and I think the last man was released, Was it in the 60s or was it in the 50s?
Yeah, it was in the 50s. Like,
okay.
Yeah, but you know, like, but to the, you know, the charges still lingered up
mm-hmm.
into the 80s and the 90s.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
it's just, you know, absurd. And you know, and you know, the lawyer Leibowitz said that, you know, it's just, you know, these people just couldn't admit that they had done something wrong. You know, they were not going to admit it. And a lot of the things that we say in the show are from the actual cases and what was said in the court. You know, it's like, you know, one of the prosecutors in the first trial says, you know, guilty or not guilty, get rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, come on. I mean, that, you know, and that was allowed to be said, you know, about black people. Just get rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just. A horrible, horrible American story, an American tragedy.
Yes,
you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. So bringing these characters to life, Ozzie Powell and Ruby Bates. You know, for I'm a dancer. I'm born. You know, I was born. You know, with tap shoes on. It seems like. But like I.
Boy, it's been painful for your mom, huh? Born with tap shoes, huh?
That's a woo. You know, I do a lot of my character work based on a lot of movement. So I find the movement of the characters
mm-hmm.
first,
mm-hmm.
you know, to find what kind of life they lead, whether it's in my posture or, you know, the way they walk. And then I move into sound and how they talk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was very, you know, I knew, you know, we're down in the South, so that there's a Southern sound there. But, you know, but with playing a woman, you know, it's at first in my audition, you know, when they asked if I could sing the song as a woman, I thought they meant like up in my falsetto and, you know, sound like a woman. They said, well, no, just, you know, sweeten it up a bit, you know, just, you know, see what you would do, you know, as a character in your own voice to find out what this woman sounds like. So, you know, taking it from there, you know, you discover how she would talk and pronounce some words, and then on from there. It's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of fun to bring these characters to life.
Yeah, I really liked your Ruby. She was very different from Victoria. And I like the piece where she sings, I don't have the program in front of me, where she admits that she lied on the stand. And she just, yeah, you do a really good job with that
Thank you.
Particular scene and that number. And the boys are there, and she's singing. It's really nice.
Yeah, it was really, really cool, and the number had grown even from the readings.
Mm.
You know, it had grown, and they added dance breaks in it, and you know, it just really grew into this really spectacular number. And like I said, it uses all of what I have in this show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all my singing, dancing, acting. You know, even different genders. You know, it
mm-hmm.
just. It uses everything you got, and the production team was really open to working with what your unique skills are,
mm-hmm.
and really, you know, having you shine, you know, in the life of this show. So
mm-hmm.
it was a lot of fun, hard work, but a lot of fun.
Yeah, I was reading your bio, and it's impressive. I mean, you know, being in two Broadway musicals at the same time, almost Chicago and
yeah.
the Scottsboro Boys. I was like, oh, that's pretty amazing. By I mean, not just this, but by this, you know, the same choreographer and same writers.
Yeah.
I was like, that's very unique, I would think.
Yeah, it was like it was really cool. And actually, there were two of us in the show because, well, actually, back on Broadway, the guy, a gentleman by the name of Coleman Domingo.
Oh, I know Coleman.
You know Coleman?
Coleman's
okay,
my
great.
Friend, yes.
Yeah, he had also done Chicago, too.
Oh.
So he wasn't in it at the same time, but he had done two, you know, Candor and Ev musicals.
Okay.
You know, but I was doing double duty. Believe me, my knees, my back hurt, everything hurt. But, you know, I am so grateful, so grateful.
Right, yeah, and I was looking at, wow, you toured with Cinderella with Eartha Kitt and
yeah.
Fame, you know, as Tyrone Jackson. I'm like, oh, I love Eartha Kitt's work. I heard that she was quite a character.
Yes, she was. She told it like it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's from a different era. They did not hold their tongue. You know, and if you were, you know, falling short, she pulled you up,
mm-hmm.
you know, real quick. And, you know, interesting thing about Eartha, you know, she never carried any money.
Oh.
So, you know, she had, you know, she was always just, you know, we went to the Piggly Wiggly when we were down in North Carolina mm-hmm. to eat. And I just was so surprised, you know, you think of people, you know. You'd think people have money on them, and she didn't carry any money because, you know, everything was just kind of like, you know, cared for, taken care of for her, you
okay.
know,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, but it was just hilarious because I was like, oh, wow, you know, it was kind of like my first dose into thinking of like, you know, oh, some people don't carry money because they don't need to carry money because, mm-hmm. you know. That's just got the kind of life they lead.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess at that point in your life, if you're not being taken care of, then someone needs to take care of you. If they don't know, so you know, whoever is taking care of, you know, your lodging and your board or whatever, and if they don't
yeah.
realize that they need to take care of everything, they soon find out that
yes,
you don't.
Yes.
It's like, no, I don't do that.
Yes,
if
yes,
you want me, you handle this.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool. That's an interesting mindset. I guess I don't know, like, when you're going to develop that, not carrying money.
I don't know either. I don't know.
Yeah.
Go ahead. And I was just going to say, and you know, she was wonderful as the fairy godmother in Cinderella.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think we on the tour, she was celebrating her 75th birthday
wow.
at the time.
Wow.
And she was just, you know, amazing,
mm.
amazing, amazing, strong, and amazing. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's wonderful. And then you have appeared twice at Carnegie Hall with the New York Pops. Like, wow.
Yeah, what a blessing.
Wow.
What a blessing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what were you singing?
Oh, well, my first program was a, what was it? It was a, one time I was there, it was an Irving Berlin show. It was a tribute to Irving Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was called Rags to Ritzes,
mm-hmm.
the New York Pops. And we sang songs like Stepping Out with My Baby and, you know, he wrote God Bless America, which I did not know until
I started working. Oh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, putting on the Ritz.
Mm-hmm.
And, and just the history in that building, you know, Carnegie Hall, you know, Ella Fitzgerald, Booker T. Washington spoke there.
He did.
Yeah,
huh.
Like, you know, he was one of the first black, if not the first black person to ever speak there.
Mm.
And I remember my dressing room was right near a picture of him, and I just thought, like, wow, Mom, I made it to Carnegie Hall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was your mom in the audience when you were singing?
Oh, of course she was.
Okay.
She comes to everything. She comes, you know, I'm from Philadelphia. And
oh, okay.
She just, you know, she comes everywhere, has always been a major supporter. And it was a magical night. And continues to be one of those really high points in my life. And, you know, I'll say, I'll come back whenever you whenever you can have me.
Right.
I'll
Well, they called you back once already. You've been twice.
Yes, they did. Yes, they did.
So it's time for them to call you again. Has it been a minute since you've been there?
You know, it's been a minute. It's coming up on two years, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Well, after you finish Scottsboro Boys, they say, okay, we've been waiting for you to get free.
That's right. Which is very interesting because, you know, because, like, we're supposed to play through July 29th,
mm-hmm.
and we just got the notice that we're going to be just playing through July 22nd.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, okay, start thinking about what's next. I've already been thinking about what's next, but now it's like, okay,
mm-hmm.
all right, God, here we go.
So you really are in the moment, huh?
I am in the moment. Mm-hmm. I am in the moment. And it's a good place to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very good place to be.
Yeah, certainly. And you've also, you've made concert appearances with the Indianapolis, Naples, Baltimore, and Ottawa symphonies as well. Like, you're famous. Like,
well, definitely working on it. You know, when I was coming up in high school, you know, I sang a lot of legit musical theater and classical musical theater stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, and not musical theater, but just legit, like, you know, opera oratorios,
mm-hmm.
and you know, arias. You know, my training is
mm-hmm.
legit.
Okay.
But a lot of musical theater, I haven't been called to do a lot of that,
mm-hmm.
you know. But, you know, but it's what I do. And so when the symphony auditions came along, you know, it was just kind of like a perfect fit for me because I had done a lot of that stuff when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it's a small world, so you do one thing and then someone hears about you and you just do another thing. And then, you know, and you get in with, you know, a conductor, you know, I often work with a maestro, Everly,
mm-hmm.
Jack Everly. He works out of the Indianapolis Symphony a lot.
Okay.
And Stephen Reinecke with the New York Pops. I've worked with him a couple of times too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, you get in and it's just a nice place to be in. You know, and it's a lot of fun. Singing with 80 pieces,
mm-hmm.
an orchestra, oh my goodness, you know.
Yeah, nice. And your tuxedo? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the brother's got chops. He's got range. Ooh. Well, San Francisco needs to call you. I was at the Fillmore Jazz Festival this weekend. Did you get a chance to go check it out a little bit, or were you working the whole time?
Well, I went to see Rochelle Farrell.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, she wasn't part of the festival, but
no, uh-huh,
I was down
yeah.
at I was down at Yoshi's
mm-hmm.
On Saturday night, and what a singer!
Mm-hmm.
What an amazing performer!
Yeah,
you know, so I've gotten to hear a little bit of jazz out of the Fillmore in this trip, but you know, we were working, so you know, we matinees, evening shows, you know, they keep us working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. Particularly
yes.
since you love what you're doing, so that's great.
Yeah.
What I was just thinking that it'd be great. When I was yesterday, I took my nieces to back to the jazz festival, Fillmore Jazz Festival, and we were walking and trying to see what things we could get free because, you know, kids like those
uh-huh.
things. And there was a booth for the San Francisco Symphony, and I didn't realize that it's 100 years old. It's celebrating
wow.
its 100th anniversary. And this past weekend on Sunday as well, which was kind of interesting, the symphony performed at Stern Grove Festival, which is celebrating its 75th anniversary. So I'm thinking, okay, well, San Francisco Symphony needs to invite you. And they're having their summer series. They have a summer sort of pops series. And Oakland East Bay Symphony, you know, is over in, you know, across the bay. So, and then there's... I'm trying to think. Does San Jose have a symphony? It might. We have a lot of symphonies in the California, in Northern California too. So yeah, we gotta like have your agent like, you know, send your whatever you do, send all your demos out or whatever. Yeah, we got to get you to come make this one of your places that you do your other stuff.
I would love that.
That'd be really fun. Yeah, because Davies Symphony Hall, you would love Davies. It's really beautiful. And the Paramount Theater in the East Bay is just a really, they're both really wonderful venues. Davies is a more modern facility. Paramount is Art Deco, is really a beautiful theater like the Castro and San Francisco. I think they're around the same period. But they both have great acoustics. So,
Wow.
Yeah, so you got to come out and do your symphony thing with us.
And light it up for the symphony. Absolutely.
Yeah. And then I was noticing how you played James Brown. Like, wow.
That was so much fun. I got all, for the audition for that, I got fully dressed in my James Brown garb. I got a wig. I put on my velvet red, jacket and pink shirt and tight pants. And, it was an audition for a Las Vegas James Brown preacher impersonator. And, I was marrying the couple of regulars on the show. And I just had a blast. They didn't know what to do with me on that show. They were just like, because, it's such a different world. I come from theater, and television is just, it's a lot smaller, a lot quieter. But I came onto that set, baby, I had so much fun.
Wow, I had so much fun, So I guess people can catch it in One Life to Live reruns, huh?
Yeah.
Right. And then you've made 3 appearances at the Tony Awards. Like, wow.
Yes. Wow. The first was with A Chorus Line, which I did on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one was with the Scottsboro Boys.
Oh.
But the one in between there, I was I kind of appeared, but you didn't see my face because I was the dance double, the body double for Whoopi Goldberg when she hosted the Tony Awards.
So it was your body dancing, but her face?
It was my body dancing.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
How did they do the technology on that?
Oh, it was like a green screen.
Oh.
And, they had me dancing and everything, and then they had Whoopi's face doing the movements and stuff like that. And it came out of, she had this great idea where she appeared in all of the plays that were happening on Broadway. She just would show up in things, and she showed up in A Chorus Line, which was still playing when she hosted it. So I showed up in the gold costume, and it was great. And she's wonderful to work with, and a huge, huge supporter of the Scottsboro Boys. She was there in New York, and she talked a lot to us and gave us a lot of words of inspiration.
Yeah. You told me when I saw you at Yoshi's Friday night that you hadn't known the story of Ozzy or the other young men who, got on that faithful train, were on that faithful train that day, and I'm sure a lot of them thought, man, God, I should have not did that. I'm stuck now. And, you think about the rides that we take, like the figurative and literal, and the destinations that we're headed on, like once we agree to participate, be a passenger. And sometimes, we make these choices and we can't get off. We have to follow it through to the end. And sometimes, we don't know where the end is. And, these young men definitely didn't because, Haywood and the other young man, drawing a blank on his name right now, the two older ones, the other young man, Clarence Norris, they kept on getting sentenced to the electric chair and then getting life sentences and things like that, which are really horrific. I wonder if you could talk about the form that the piece takes, because there's been a lot of controversy around the whole idea of the the vaudeville form and
and
the parody and then at the end, like I was telling you all, you know, that blackface was not working for me. At the end, it's like you should have just cut it after Haywood says, "All right, this is all I can do." That would have been great to end it right there.
But like I, you know, like we talked about earlier, you know, the, well, the device that we use to tell the story is the minstrel show, and a minstrel show, you know, it allows all of the characters involved to play multiple characters, which is great to tell the story. I mean, budget wise, you know, you have nine boys and like and two and men, which in the minstrel show are called Mr. Tambo and Mr. Bones, and then you have the interlocutor who's kind of like the middleman, you know, and the Tambo and Bones have all the jokes, and the interlocutor is like the straight man in the form, but you get to use all of these characters. And in the 1930s, the minstrel show, that was you know, it predates vaudeville, but that was a viable a form of entertainment at that time. So it's time appropriate. It's not that this device was just chosen all willy-nilly because we're going to talk about black people at this time. It was the form of entertainment that was being used at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's how we decided to tell the story. Now, being that we do start the show, you know, as storytellers, and we go into the story, we are already involved in the minstrel device at the start of the show. The reason why we do the blackface at the end is for two reasons. One is to drive home the point that we've always been involved in this minstrel show, and this is just one aspect that you're seeing. You're now seeing it fully on, like bare bones. This is what we've been seeing all night.
Mm-hmm.
But also, we and this is the main point that we talked about in the development of this piece, is that we, throughout the whole night, we have been challenging not only the minstrel show device as just like a horrible, horrible thing to be involved in, but throughout the night, we've been like turning the minstrel show on its ear. We've been, you know, we're black people doing a black minstrel show, and it's usually, well, white people did the black show face, and then eventually black people did it because that was the only viable form. But in the jokes that we tell, and in telling the story and taking back our power throughout the night, we put on the blackface to take it off, to say we're not going to take it anymore. We need change. We need something new.
Mm-hmm.
And Haywood sings a song, "You Can't Do Me Like You Done Me Before,"
mm-hmm.
and we're not gonna stand it anymore. We're not gonna take it anymore. So that's why we take it off, to show that we're not gonna take it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a really, really, really powerful statement. You know, yes, there's a lot of shock value to it. Yes, 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 yes. But, you know, we can't keep, it is a part of our history. It's a part of black history. It's a part of American history.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened. It's real, you know. And, you know, the more that we can accept the fact that it happened and it's real and it's a part of our history, you know, we don't have to forget it. You know, we can move on from it, but, you know, but it's an important part of our history, and this is a historical show. This is what happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just thinking when I was writing about this, I was thinking about the Tuskegee experiment, and
mm-hmm.
that's actually that's a play as well, and it's not a musical. And it was also performed at ACT, and I wondered about. I hear you're telling me that during this particular period, the minstrel show was the way that theater was. That was the form. Yeah, but I'm wondering if this particular story was not told in this form. I mean, I know that's what the writer and the choreographer, this is the type of theater that they do. musical theater.
And yeah.
I know it on Broadway is musical theater. So if you want to be on Broadway, it's got musical theater. So I'm wondering, but I don't think everything on Broadway is musical theater, but
almost
everything is. And then, yeah, and I think about...
There are a lot of plays, too.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, like, okay, why... I mean, I don't know if you know the Tuskegee Experiment, the play, and I don't know if it made it to Broadway, but it did make it to ACT, and it's a tale about a travesty of justice in American history, you know. In this case, these men, these black men, were not treated for syphilis, but they thought they were being treated for syphilis, and so that they could be unwilling and unknowingly used as guinea pigs to see how the disease progressed, and so we have this in it's not a musical, and I'm thinking about other stories that this one, you know, this particular is a story that's a real story, the Scottsboro Boys, that actually happened, and then right on Broadway right now there is the Porgy and Bess, and that has been rewritten by Susan Laurie Parks, who's had a lot of things on Broadway. And I'm like, okay, so that's that's Gershwin, you know, he and his brother, and he's rewriting something that didn't work, and we've got Scott Joplin, who wrote things that work, and that could be on Broadway, and they're musicals too, about the black experience and, you know, black community, and it's just really lovely writing. So I'm just wondering about sort of the use of a story that, you know, is an American story, but it's also a black story, and I don't know if there are any black people in the creative team, but just sort of who's the audience?
Who's the audience?
I think
theater people, theater lovers are the audience, you know. I think, you know, I don't know, we didn't go into the Scottsboro Boys thinking of a black audience or a white audience. I mean, I think people who want to be informed and entertained and who want to see good theater are our audience. I do think it closed on Broadway because of the timing. I mean, it's not a, you know, in New York City at the holiday season is, you know, they don't want to come and see the Scottsboro Boys. You know, I think they, you know, it, the timing was wrong for our show. And I think that's why it closed. Like I said, you know, I think it's people who want to see really good theater who want to come and see your show. You know, who, you know, entertainment isn't just about, you know, happy, happy, happy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's about, you know, being entertained and challenged and leaving with something and having a conversation after the show. This show definitely leaves you wanting to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know.
Yeah, it does. I went to the theater on the couch. That's funny name for the after the conversations afterwards down in the area where there the refreshments are in the bar, and having the discussions facilitated by a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
That's kind of funny. I hear what you're saying, and I don't know. I just wonder what Haywood would say, what Ozzie would say if they could see this version of their story. What would they say? What would Ozzie say?
Well, I have no idea.
No, of course not. You know, but you're embodying his spirit. So what would he say?
I have no idea. but this is what I think is important.
Uh-huh.
You know, like when I first started to get involved with this show back in 2009, I hadn't heard about the Scottsboro Boys.
Mm-hmm.
So a new generation of people all over the world, possibly, because you can go on YouTube, you can Google, you know, if you like musical theater, you can find the Scottsboro Boys. You know, it was a part of a season on Broadway. So people who would have never thought to check out the Scottsboro Boys because there's this interest in it, and it's been turned into a musical theater piece.
Mm-hmm.
Now they know about these guys' story, and they were forgotten. So now they know. So I think that there's some satisfaction in that now more people know about this story and about these boys individually, and not just the Scottsboro Boys all grouped up in one little ball. Now they know about Uzi and Haywood and Clarence and Willie and Eugene and Roy and Andy. Now they know about these boys individually, these guys. And they know about the tragedies that happen. And I can't help but think that they are really happy about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, we still have a long way to go in terms of equality and justice. I think this show helps in that direction. So.
Yeah. I certainly agree with your reasoning. It makes a lot of sense what you just said, and sort of following along those lines, Haywood clearly gives us a task in his closing line, and then that's picked up by the silent woman who finally talks. Rosa Parks, and I wonder if you could talk about that. You know, the silent woman and her presence, because we've got she's a real woman playing a female role, and then we've got, you know, you're playing a woman, and then we've got another actor who's a man who's playing a woman. You know,
she definitely. That's a great point. She is kind of like the observer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she plays the silent observer. She's not a part of the minstrel show. We, as characters in the minstrel show,
mm-hmm.
or in this production that we're putting on, can play different characters. But she is, outside of that, observing and kind of, in a sense, kind of remembering what happened back then.
Mm-hmm.
And I think her role is so important, you know, played by C. Kelly Wright. She becomes every woman, every observer. If you're a mother waiting for your child to come home, or a lover, you know, or just an observer, you know, a silent witness, you know, how about the mothers that, you know, long for the children to come home but could not do anything about it except, you know, wait,
mm-hmm.
because they were black, you know, or if you've ever, you know, witnessed an injustice and couldn't, you know, do anything about it, you know, she was that, you know, kind of observer. She had that perspective of the show, and then at the end, you know, where, you know, she reappears as the character that she does, and decides that, you know, she's not gonna, you know, take it anymore, mm-hmm. and she's gonna stay right where she is. It's a very, very, very powerful moment for us. You know, she has quite a journey throughout her story. I like to think of it as all, you know, kind of happening in her memory.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in her mind.
Ah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, just maybe like a few minutes have passed, or, you know, how you just think about a story and you can remember so many aspects of the story,
mm-hmm.
in a moment, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and just, it, I think the story of the Scottsboro Boys helps her to make that decision to stay right where she is on that bus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also heard that it was what happened to Emmett Till as well that made her sit there.
Mm-hmm.
And she was familiar with the case because her husband was a part of a support group that raised funds for they had to do it in secret because it was a lot of danger in, you know, being a black man in the South, and then being a black man in the South that was raising funds for this case for these young men that needed a lot of support monetarily. Because, you know, they couldn't do anything with regards to protecting them physically, but they definitely could send money, you know, to their representatives so that they could, you know, have the best counsel that money could buy. And he didn't want his wife to come because it was so dangerous, and he had to like switch up where they were hosting the meetings and things like that.
It meant your life.
Right. So I was thinking, why since this case does have resonance in the present, here in the San Francisco Bay Area, California. You think about what happened with Oscar Grant. You think about some of the other cases, you know, where young men have just been executed when clearly the evidence was saying, hold up, we might be making a mistake here. But then, you know, Troy Anthony Davis is killed, right? And then we think about the young man being shot in Florida. So why are there no tables with information about the current measure that's on the ballot for California looking at, you know, the death penalty? And then we have organization called Legal Services for Prisoners with Children that's right there in San Francisco. All of Us or None was founded by one of the persons who started Legal Services, Dorsey Nunn. That's in San Francisco. We've got Prison Focus magazine. We've got like all these organizations that are looking at, you know, what's going on in California. You've got young people that their first time incarcerated, nonviolent crimes, or they didn't actually commit the crime, 25 years to life. I mean, that's all happening when you all are doing this play, and so that has current residence for people. I mean, the people that are subscribers to ACT, they live here in the San Francisco Bay Area. They could get involved. They could be like, you know, they could take the charge that Haywood says, all right, you know, I've done all I can do, you know, and they could say, okay, and so these organizations would have leaflets, you know, out in the lobby, or maybe they could be a part of the on the couch. They could just say a few words, maybe, you know, maybe a different organization at each on the couch, you know. Because a lot of times with film, when there's a film that is, it might be a doc or it might not be a documentary, and they're having a screening where the director is in the house, they'll invite organizations that are conversant in whatever the issue is that are right located right there in the place where they're screening, because they're going to be, the organization's going to be there when they leave to be a part of the screening. So I'm thinking, well, why? And I know ACT has done this before. That's why I'm mentioning it. For other types of plays that have a social justice kind of resonance.
That sounds like a great idea. I don't know why that didn't happen.
Yeah, but since you all are going to be around till the 21st, right?
Is that 22nd.
22nd, yeah, so it's been extended, which is great. I don't know who I would speak to, but I don't mind, you know, making this recommendation to whomever. So maybe you can think about it and let me know who... you know, who we should talk to be able to invite, because I know they come, because I'm a member of an organization that's California Coalition for Women Prisoners, which is, the fiscal sponsor is Legal Services for Prisoners with Children. So I know a lot of these organizations that I just mentioned to you because I've worked with them. And then we've got Angela Davis's Critical Resistance, you know, and that's looking at the whole prison industrial complex. Yeah, so there's a real wealth of prison abolitionists and social justice workers here in around the prison system. You know, juveniles, which is what we're looking at in the Scottsboro Boys. These are children. I mean, 13 years old. Oh my God. crazy. Yeah, yeah, babies. And it's still happening. I mean, there are children that are being locked up in Texas, in California, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida. I mean, still today.
Mm.
So it's not just a play. It's not just history. It's current.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and
I think a lot about, in doing this play,
mm-hmm.
I think a lot about Trayvon Martin and
mm-hmm.
what happened down there.
Yeah.
For some reason, that case in particular comes up a lot in my thinking and my prayers, and as an artist, we all have our passions and we all have our, callings.
Mm-hmm.
I feel extremely grateful that I get to tell this story
mm-hmm.
as an artist, because
yeah.
I do feel like, I'm doing something in my own way, to have an awareness,
mm-hmm.
Be out there,
Yeah, and you all are so good too. I mean, it's just, it's just so compelling because we really feel it. I mean, you all are so passionate in your portrayals of these young men, and even though we know the story, and we know it's not a happy story. I mean, you can read it beforehand, or you can read about it afterwards, but it doesn't feel like it's going to be a happy story. This child's having nightmares about being electrocuted.
Mm-hmm.
He is just great, that child who plays
him.
He's marvelous. So I think the audience might feel a little better if they knew that they could do something, as opposed to just sitting with this, like if they just feel like so heavy. Afterwards, like, okay, well, all right, so I know this story. Okay, like, what? Now what? Yeah, I think when you give somebody something to do as opposed to telling them, okay, now you need to take it, but you give them some options, I think it makes the work live afterwards.
I think that's a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's very, very important.
Yeah, particularly if you're feeling a little guilt. Sometimes, people see things in the theater and they bring stuff up, they're not personally responsible, but they might feel some guilt. We're Americans and, we've got this justice system and it doesn't work for everybody.
Mm.
And, it's still not working. And some people might take that really to heart and just feel really bad about that but don't know what to do with it. I remember someone saying something about, we have these protest marches. Like, you don't just bring people together and rile them up and don't give them something to do. it's not a good thing. And also, it's a misuse of the energy. I mean, we could, like, channel that into something constructive.
Mm-hmm.
And you all really stir us up. Really stir us up. I mean, and we're like captive. I mean, it's like, all right, so it starts and there's no intermission. Like, okay. those kind of situations where it's like, okay, I can't leave because I don't want to miss anything. And, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm, yeah. So anyway, let me know sort of what I can do with that idea.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure. I mean, I don't know how we do have a little bit of time left, and I know they have some talk back scheduled.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Maybe we can, somebody you can talk to over there
mm-hmm.
Would be interested in doing something like that.
Okay.
I don't know what the, like you said, ACT has done something like that before,
mm-hmm.
and we did lots of things like that on Broadway, actually.
Oh, okay.
Folks from the Scottsboro Boys Museum came.
Oh, there's a museum? Where is it?
Yeah, it's in Scottsboro.
Oh, nice. Have you been?
Yeah. No, I haven't.
Mm-hmm.
But they came to Broadway.
Nice.
And we raised money and lots of things went on. So,
that's awesome.
It could be a number of reasons why. But with the time that's left, maybe something can happen. That'd be great.
Yeah. Okay, well, cool. Well, thanks for letting me know what has happened. So that could be sort of a place where ACT could look, you know, for an example, if they don't have one immediately in mind. But we don't have to necessarily invite the museum here, but that would be kind of cool, too. Yeah. Okay. Wow, it's been such a wonderful conversation. Wow, this has been really great, James. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Yeah, it's been really, really lovely. Yeah, and good luck on the rest of the run. Maybe I might be able to get back through there. See if I can bring some of my students before the semester ends or summer session ends. Yeah, they're so deeply entrenched in their writing essays. I don't know if they can, I can pull them away. Yeah, but thank you so much for sharing so much of your time with us today on this in this interview. And yeah, I'm gonna broadcast it and let you know what the feedback is.
Cool.
And I'll send you a link as well.
Oh, I would love that.
Okay. As I mentioned, there was a third part, like the thank yous and everything, and I'm going to play that as well. And we're going to close the show with a song. Nina Simone took Lorraine Hansberry's the play that was produced after she passed, which sort of was a compilation of her writings and her speeches. It's called To Be Young, Gifted, and Black. And Nina Simone has a song that she composed by that title, which is really lovely. So we're going to move from James T. Lane's closing thank yous into Nina Simone. And I want to just remind people and congratulate Adrian Anderson on the 10th anniversary of the 10th anniversary of the of the International Black Women's Film Festival. And I was going to look for the details about that. They have a great website, and the website is IBWFF.com, IBW, IB as in black, W, women, FF, filmfestival.com. And they're having a really wonderful guest for this opening weekend, and it's just, you know, simply phenomenal. And let me find that for you. The woman who played the lead in The Help, Octavia, who got the Oscar.